Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Welcome to Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley on the Blake Radio Network. On each and every show, Doc takes you inside the world of sports to hear from the movers, shakers, and decision makers. I know you thought there were seven wonders of the universe, where here's the eighth, Doc Stanley.
Now stay here, man.
Doc Stanley, Sports in Depth on the Blake Radio Network. Rainbow Souls, the channel. Sports Depth is the show. We open every show with John Coltrane's Dear Lord for the apropos prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you for another day. We thank you, the Lord, for the little things we so largely take for granted. And the Lord, we ask you to not give us what we want, but give us what we need. And we need thee every hour. We thank you for blessings unseen, unmerited, forthcoming, and in the past. And more importantly, the Lord, let your way be our way. We thank you for another day. As we look back, we ask you to bless the families of late Whitney Houston and, of course, Hall of Fame catcher Gary Carter. But more importantly, Lord, we thank you for your darling son Jesus. And although you may not be everybody's God, you're God all by yourself, dear Lord. And we ask these blessings, all the blessings, in the name of your darling son Jesus. Amen. Doc Stanley, Sports and Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soldiers. Jason, Sports in Depth is the show. It is a Sunday, and the crew is here. I've got a call coming in from a native New Yorker, my good friend. She paid off the email, Anthony Emil Nguyen-Dam, one of these guys who's just a native New Yorker, talking about the sensation of Jerry Lynn. Danny Skiles supposed to join us. And also,
I'm here, Doc.
Danny, okay. Is Tony
I'm here
with
too.
Us?
I'm here too, brother.
Oh,
if you guys can hear me, I'm here.
Okay. And we've got also the rest of the crew here, C-Wings and crew. A real quick.
I'm here. Harold Weston is here.
Harold Weston Jr., the first African American matchmaker in the history of Madison Square Garden. And a couple of things here. We supposed to have Danny in and a call in. The racism in sports, and somehow there's, well, I believe it, I got a call in. Is a believer that there doesn't exist in sports. Anthony, illuminated by the play of Mr. Lynn. Anthony, we're happy to celebrate your 60th birthday. I know we got you in here real quick. You've been ecstatic by the play of the new guard from the Knicks, and you have come back and been re-energized as a New York Knicks fan.
Well, hey, listen, man. You know, I retired Navy chief. Hey, I love you very much, man. I'm just happy that we have somebody that's doing something with the Knicks, man. You know, I've been a fan all my life, obviously. And, you know, there's been a big hype about he's Asian. He's just igniting the team. That's what he's doing. And, you know, I'm very happy about that. And we can't look at it as an ethnic thing. We have to look at it as that he's energizing the New York fans. And that's all I want to say about that.
And you talk, too, with your pride of being a New Yorker and the outstanding alumni of basketball players from New York City. I mean, we just...
Right. Well, you know, you know, Dr. Stanley, you know, obviously, you know, everybody that's on here, Harold Weston knows, you know, we're a basketball city. It's not like you down south and you got all the guys that play football, basketball, and all of that. We're from New York. You got Bob Cousy. You got Nate Archibald. You got the Fleming brothers from the Queensbridge Projects. You got Bob Cousy. We're a basketball town, and I've been let down a lot because of the fact that you know we have everybody you know from Tony Archibald, from Kareem to Dr. J from Philadelphia. You know. We've been giving love to everybody else, and we ain't got no love in our city. The last person that ignited our team was John Starks, you know. And I hope I didn't say anything out of the ordinary, but, you know, that's how I feel, you know. Mm-hmm. We're concrete. We play basketball in New York. It's not like, you know, we got Emmitt Smith from Pensacola. We play basketball in New York City. That's what we do. And this Asian guy has ignited the city. And you see Spike's over there with 17, with Lynn. And you know, son, I'm going to buy a jersey, too, because he has revised the city's love for basketball.
Anthony, we also this time would like to salute you, a guy who did a career in the military. As we look back on our veterans who have given their life to serve in our country, so we want to kudos out to you for that too. Now, how many years did you do in the Navy, Mr. Nordam?
I did 20, and I got 18 in the school system now here in Florida. But hey, listen, I want to tell Howard Weston, man, I love that brother, man.
I always love that brother, man. I love Howard Weston more than you.
I know there's
a lot of people on here, and I just want to, you know, I'm very honored to be on this evening. And, I did 20 years in the Navy, and I did 20 years. I got 20 almost in the school system here in Florida. But, you know, my high school's emblem is a Patriot emblem because they're the Patriots. And I tell them I wear a New York hat, and I tell them, hey, you know, figure it out. I will always be from New York. I love my city, and I love the people that's on this channel tonight, man. You know, hey, listen, this Asian dude is bringing us back on the map, you know? And it doesn't matter if he's Asian. It matters that it's New York City basketball, and that's what we're
it
about.
It does matter. I don't think he's Asian. He's not Asian. Now? He's American, brother.
He's American, yeah, you know.
Yeah, he's American.
But I don't see
that much basketball, but I never see an American flag in it.
Is Tony here with us too right now?
No, I'm still here. I want somebody else to talk.
No, not Tony.
Are you guys talking about Tony Fiorino? That's me.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great, man. I mean, hey, listen, you can say he's Asian, you can say he's white, you can say he's black. It's cool to be American when it serves you well. Whenever somebody comes out of the woodwork and does something unique, they become Asian, they become black, they become Italian.
Listen, this guy
does not fit the mold of what everybody expected an NBA point guard to be. So it doesn't matter that he's Asian. It really only matters that he's not black. That's the only racial thing that's involved in this. The man's playing real well. He's got people watching the NBA who were not watching the NBA, myself included. So it's all good.
Yeah, you're right.
Let me say this if I may, okay? This is Mel Smith Jr. here, and I just wanted to say that, you know, the first time I saw Lynn play, I told Doc and his very vast audience straight up, you didn't call him what you want, but he's the truth.
Yeah.
The young man is the truth.
Let's back up. Now, Tony, you said you weren't watching the NBA until he emerged as a star?
He's made the NBA interesting. This guy's the best thing to happen to the NBA in a long time.
Why is that? Because he's not African American?
No, it's because he's got – I don't care what color he is. The man's creating some excitement.
Right, right. Hey, Mel, can I say something? I was at a competition last week. It was a Costa Rican kid. He was telling me, Chief, have you seen this guy Jeremy Lin? And you know what I said? I never heard of the brother. He said, Chief, he ain't a brother. He's Chinese. I said, oh, damn, that makes it even better. Okay, go ahead.
But why does that make it even better?
It makes it better because of the fact that it's good. It's good because basketball is a game for everyone.
They
talk about diversity. It's called acculturation and assimilation. When you're brainwashed, you automatically think that somebody is that particular color, and he wasn't. So I went on board with that.
But that makes sense. But, guys, you know what? It's not like this guy wasn't good. This guy was touted by one of the ESPN analysts as one of the top players in the game. I mean, he was one of the 12 most versatile players in college basketball.
Because the thing here is this: Doc Stanley Sports Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul Channel Sports Depth Show. The thing here, if this guy was talented as a talent, you know, we've got to look at the coach and say, what happened? I mean, he wasn't playing the guy. I mean, he had to
Doc,
see the guy in practice.
Can I inject something in here?
Hold on, Lady A. Okay. The guy, they must have the same. If,
If you got that kind of insight, Tony, the Knicks must have had some scouting reports on him. The coach is watching the guy play every game. The coach is watching the guy in practice. I mean, how come he didn't see it, and it wasn't until his back was against the wall that he played the guy?
It's for the very reason you're having the show today. The man
does not look like
what you want an NBA point guard to look like.
Whoa.
Right,
okay.
Exactly.
Doc, can I say something?
Back up. Okay.
No.
So then.
The lady wants to talk, man. Let her talk.
Hey, pop, it ain't her show, baby. Back off.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Lady A.
Well, what I was going to say is one of the things that I found quite intriguing was the fact that the major media seems to be harping on this issue about Carmelo Anthony coming back and fitting in the team and how he's going to mold in with the team, but yet and still, had it not been for Carmelo going to the coach and telling him, play the kid, he wouldn't have been given the light and the opportunity to be where he is today. So I just find it quite compelling that now all of a sudden everybody's giving this kid and trying to form some kind of like animosity or something like that between Carmelo and his new fit coming into the team. But yet and still, if it wasn't for this kid, he wouldn't even be playing.
You bring up a good point. Yeah, I remember when the Knicks were going to get Earl Monroe, and it was a known fact that Coach Holtzman didn't want Earl because he felt that Earl wouldn't fit into the mold and scheme of the type of ball that the Knicks play, which is, you know, is just crazy. I mean, everybody wants to win, and everybody knows how to play the game, and I think 2 and 2 is always 4. So, I mean, if we got to work together to play together. One of the things, too, now the hype, the whole Chris of this story is of the show, and I wonder if my man Milo joined us today. Now, Danny, you brought Tony in under the guise that, is this really that Tony thinks there's no racism in sports?
What? I think there's reverse racism in sports, if anything.
Well, talk about it, Tony.
Yeah, like I said, this isn't a story. I mean, let's call it what it is. I don't care what color you are, but if Jeremy Lin was black, this would not be the story it is, and that's a fact.
Hmm.
Anyone want to disagree with that one?
In New York.
Well, listen, anyone want to disagree
know, I always
with that,
that
one?
Jeremy Lin is the Kevin Miles of basketball. Let's wait a while to see what he does, what he brings to the table. I don't think he's, you know, I think it'll fade. It'll fade in a couple of weeks. We won't even be talking about Jeremy Lin.
I disagree.
That he's from Harvard, and that's about it. You know, people always want to make a hero out of nothing. This guy, 3 weeks, and he's already a star, and already putting him in the All-Star game. And you know what?
It shows you the mentality of people in this country, because when you really look at it, you know, everybody goes to Chinatown to eat Chinese food, you know. Now, that might not be a factor in this, but, you know, all of us are involved in this. Because, see, I don't care what he looks like. I want New York basketball back. If Spike is wearing a jersey with 17 on it,
I just want to see
a championship. So, I want to take that racism out of that. Because if you want to talk about racism,
you people brought it in because it's always a Chinese flag out there.
Listen, man. You know, I'm New York born and bred. My family's from South America, from Suriname. I don't know if you know what that country's about, if you know where it's at. Okay? Outside of Africa, the largest black population is Brazil.
Yeah, the island. Go ahead.
Okay, so what I'm saying is, like, why are we discussing about racism, man? Listen, let's get a championship and screw the racism.
Well,
amen. Got my vote.
You know,
I was raised
in New York. There was a big thing about Puerto Ricans, Dominicans. Hey, listen, man. Take that, scratch it out.
Yeah, but Anthony, you're never going to take that out because racism is fiber. Back off.
Okay.
You're not going to take that out because, unfortunately, that's the fiber of this country. Okay? I mean, you know, let's look at situations here. I mean, the Mann Act was implemented to get Jack Johnson. The United States government implemented the Mann Act to get Jack Johnson. Okay? Black players couldn't play in the major leagues until 1947. And today's
listen,
game, we have less black players.
About,
huh?
Tell them about, listen, Ryan Braun, right, MVP. They knew he was taking steroids. They didn't do nothing to him. They let him play. You know, Manny Ramirez gets caught using steroids. Oh, we're going to suspend him. That's it. He's gone. It's double standard here, pal. We can't have it both ways. That's all I'm saying. We can't have be Jerry Lynn, the superstar, because he's Asian. And then, oh, well, you know, and then, you know, we can't have it both ways. You just can't. And
we're gentlemen,
Sports in Depth. And Tony, now, you're from ESPN, aren't we correct?
I have a show that's on a couple of ESPN affiliates, yes.
Okay. Give us your name of your show.
My name is, the show is called Hey Coach Tony.
Mm-hmm. And
the show is primarily geared to parents and coaches of athletes that are high school age and younger. So we talk about all kinds of stuff that's, you know, getting wrong with these kids at a very young age and how what's happening in the pro ranks affects these kids and their perceptions.
Now, have you had the show, Tony?
A couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And are you from New York originally? Where are you from originally?
I was born in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. I live now in Westchester County.
Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. Okay. Well, you know, glad to have you with us and definitely stay here. Mel Smith, you had something to say for us.
Doc, I have a point that's just begging to be made, and thank you for, you know, the opportunity to state this. Let me say this, okay? Here in the U.S., and especially the U.S. media, they're always, forever looking for the next big thing, okay? The reason that this is an international story is not only because of the energy and the ink that he's been getting here from the New York press and obviously the change in Nick's style. But the fact that he is Asian has made this an international story, not just here but abroad, okay? When they were showing that game on ABC today with the Knicks and the Mavericks, all right? I believe they cut into where they were watching it overseas, okay, in Asia. So that is one of the reasons and partly why this has turned into not only a New York story, not only a basketball story, but an international story that's crossed the boundaries of just basketball.
Yeah, hey, can I say something, man? I'm a retired Navy chief. I went to Spain in 1985, and I was sitting down. I was watching TV because at that time they didn't have internet over there, and they finally got satellite in my community where I lived in Madrid. And I was sitting there, and I was watching a game with Bob McAdoo, okay, playing in Israel. So, you know, the whole thing of this thing, man, is that every individual looks at it as a race thing. It ain't no race thing. Okay, you know, on a normal day, he could be a brother playing normal basketball, okay? He ignited New York. New York took it, and that's it. Because we have to separate this racism thing, man. This thing is an old hat. It's an old hat, and you got to get away from that, man. You got to get away from that.
I think we've gotten so far away from it, it's swinging in the other direction.
He ain't no Pearl Manigault, you know. He ain't no Kareem, you know.
Manigault, oh, my God, that's old school.
You know, I mean, you know, I don't know how old you guys are, but let me tell you something, man. Malcolm X said he had a book, it's called The End of White World Supremacy, and he said the Asian race was going to rule now. It don't matter how that boy's playing. He could be normal brother in the hood, but, you know, for me, he's igniting New York, and I like that.
Everyone likes it.
Anthony, we're talking about when they made that song Native New Yorker, they should have put Anthony Emil Newendam on that cover. Doc Stanley Sporting Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soldiers Channel, Sporting Depth in the show. The crew is here and our special guest, Tony Fino. Lady A, have your say.
Yeah, I was just going to say cut, but he's, you know, I think that his negatives are starting to be a little exploited too, because it kind of reminded me of this girl I used to have to guard when I was playing high school ball called No Left Beth. You took away her left. She couldn't even drive. She couldn't drive with her left.
I hear you. Hey, you're right. Because, you know, he's driving. He's fumbling a little bit, man. He's going to have to get a grip on that.
And he's got to get a grip on that.
Now, listen, Stoudemire's back and Melo is back and then someone's shooting a three-pointer. Listen, this kid's going to be laying up a ton of assists. His points will go down. His turnovers will go down. That's what a point guard does.
Right. And you're right. Whoever's talking, you're actually right.
Tony, you know, you talked about, you talked about your program is dealing with You said high school kids moving toward college and the pros?
It's the show is for parents. It's for the adults involved in scholastic and youth sports. That's the gist of it. So we talk about everything from, you know, when a referee gets punched in the face to when, you know, a coach has to deal with parents who complain that their kid don't get enough time on the floor and everything in between. That's what it's about. So the good news is my stuff don't go away. I got something to talk about every week.
Damn, I hear you.
So I mean, is that really a serious situation, that kind of thing? My kid is not playing, all that kind of stuff, Tony?
You kidding me? Football coach in Texas got shot in the chest because of it.
Shit.
It happens all the time. That ain't no joke.
What? Shot in the chest?
Yeah,
Google it. Football coach replaced the starting quarterback, and the dad came back with an assault rifle, shot the coach in the chest. It happens, not that drastic, but there are fights, there are arguments, there are crimes. You know, one hockey dad doesn't like the way the other guy's running practice, and he beat him to death in front of the kids. The, you know, you can't make the stuff up. But, you know, and those are the role models these kids are following.
You know,
Tony, hold on, gang.
Involved.
Hold on, Doc's got another question.
No. Go ahead. Incidentally, gang, you know, we have the ESPN sportscaster here, Tony Fenino. We also, you know, on this panel tonight, we're lucky to be graced by Chief Petty Officer Anthony Damp. As a lot of you know, C-Wings, our football ex-husband guru, is a police captain active, as is our Lady A, who is a police captain, police lieutenant. Harold Weston Jr., former welterweight champion and MSG matchmaker, and Mel Smith Jr., also former WWF star. And so we've got a select group here. Yo, getting back to you, Tony, now what pushed you into this, also Danny Skiles, what pushed you into this kind of work? It's unique, but what made you go into this endeavor, Tony?
Long story short, you know, the one thing that has always been wrong with kids' sports is adults. And so now that I have – well, guy, I mean, look,
it's the
way
it
is. That's the only thing that's wrong with kids' sports is adults.
Wow.
And now that I have three kids, I've been coaching kids since I've been a teenager. And now I have three kids. One of them is in high school. The other two are in middle school. And I see and live and breathe this stuff every day. And, you know, it's never going to go away. But if I can give someone a little bit of advice on how to handle some of these situations and talk about it the way we're talking about it now instead of like some PhD, that's compelling to people and it gets through to them. So making the world a little bit better, one idiot at a time.
C-Wings, you want to interject with something with Tony?
No, I wanted to ask him. Do you start to see more cases now of increased violence from the families? I mean, you've seen in the last about year or so. I mean, I've seen a story where I think it was football, where one of the kids tackled the other one, and then the father got involved and tackled the kid.
Yeah, I believe that was down in Florida. I mean, that was at the youth level. And the short answer is, my friend, for the past 10 years, there's been a trend of significantly increased violence. And the problem is it's starting to happen. I mean, I had a guy on my show a couple weeks ago. He was the chief umpire at a sixth-grade girls softball tournament. And he got punched in the face for trying to break up a fight between a coach and a parent. You know, We just live so much through our kids, and we get so frustrated that we don't play anymore, that we want them to do so great. And the problem is we don't allow them to fail. And that, I mean, getting back to what we're talking about with Jeremy Lin, you know what? The kid had a bad game. The Knicks lost, and everyone went nuts. Did we really think the Knicks weren't going to lose another game and that this kid was never going to play a bad game? Sometimes the most important part about any athlete is what he does after he fails. And you know what the good news is? After he failed, the kid came back and played great again, and he won.
All right, but Tony, don't you think that the problem we'll be having with these athletes and the mothers and, I mean, the fathers being with
parents.
The kids, parents, is because the money is so great out there in the sports world than what there were back in the 60s and 70s, where now the parents are taking their kids and trying to move them fast into the sports world and try to give them those major contracts, and that's where the problem is?
Well, the problem is that parents don't have any perspective. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, of all the kids that are playing high school varsity, the best high school athletes, less than 5% of them are just going to even play in college, much less get a scholarship.
My point is that a lot of the parents are pushing their kids through this because of the fact that they figure that their kid might get these big contracts in the sports world, and that's the reason why they're right there, and they want their kids to always be out there playing.
But I think, what Tony's trying to say too it's all too at the degree that the parents are involved, because we look at the Williams sisters in tennis, their father was out there, you know, taking them out to play at a very, very young age, and not every time do you have one, the parents participate in a positive way like that, encouraging their kids, and number two, not on top of that, you don't have with the younger kids, sometimes you don't have that mental state of mind with these kids where they're geared to understand that failure is part of winning. When you
fail, sometimes you're also
winning, because you're able to correct your mistakes. You're able to learn about things dealing just with life in general. I mean, Harold, how many times haven't you mentioned in the show how sometimes these guys don't have discipline, but also a lot of times they're not taught things the proper way. But failure is part of learning.
If you think you're going to go through any sports career, and any great coach will tell you this, nobody expects you to never fail. Coaches want to see what happens when you fail. I don't know if any of you guys know the name Todd Marinovich.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Well, what happened? That kid was one of the most heralded quarterbacks in the history of game coming through college. He was supposed to be the next great thing. And I will tell you, 90% of football fans don't even remember who that guy is. Because of, you know, no matter how much daddy does, when the day's done, you've got to have the mental capacity to succeed and fail. And we do so much to shield our kids from this failure that they don't know how to fail. And the first time they do, they flip out. I mean, failure is not only something that's acceptable, it's important to develop a kid.
You know, you bring up a great point that Marion Boykin always talked about. Marion B. Boykin, always say black, bodacious, brilliant brother, greatest boxing show in the history of television. He said, you know, the ultimate measure of a champion is what he does after the first loss, what he does after he gets knocked down. You know, what does he do after that, after the O is gone? And you know, you're talking – Tony, now give us the correct pronunciation of your last name.
Last name is Fiorino.
Okay, Fiorino, okay.
Fiorino.
And you're saying so much, and Harold, as you know, being a former championship boxer, what Tony is saying too, the avenue of when the defeat does come. Hank Aaron said it's amazing that in baseball you seem successful and you make out 7 out of 10 times, and yet the interjection by Harold, Tony, is the fact that, you know, the money has become so big that the parents are taking more.
They lose sight of reality, Doc. My thing is this, and I'm going to say it right out.
If they were getting paid, they knew that their kid was going to make $100,000 playing football.
Right.
Okay, that's the top salary.
Mm-hmm.
Those parents would not have their kids out there playing football. They say get a college education, get your grades. They would not have them uniform on. But when they're making millions of dollars,
right,
signing a contract,
mm-hmm,
now all the parents are involved in the sport. And that's the amazing thing. Because I remember in the 60s and the 70s, parents were not that much involved in kids' sports. But when we got to that million dollar point, was that Harold Weston talking now?
Yeah, when we got to that million dollar point, then
things started changing.
Hold on, Tony. Hold on.
That was Danny.
Tony. No, we got the.
I want to ask Harold a question, man. I ain't seen him in years.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Can I ask Harold a question?
Yeah, go ahead. Ask him a question.
I mean, it has nothing to pertain to what's going on, but I love Harold so much.
I know it was something. Hey, you boxing.
No, I just want to, it doesn't mean anything because I'm getting ready to hang up. I got to take my kid to school tomorrow. But, Harold, can I ask you a question, man?
Yeah, go ahead.
The difference between a 12-round fight and a 15-round fight, you know, Monson, Sugar Ray, and Hagler, you know, do you think that those last rounds make a difference, Harold? I want to hear from you because, you know, I was talking to a kid the other day. I mean, these kids don't understand me about, you know, Dooku Kim and Mancini and, you know, Aguayo and Aaron Pryor. Do you think those last rounds separates the boys from the men?
Most definitely it does in a lot of ways because we wouldn't have had a lot of our great champions would never be great champions today if it wasn't a 15-round fight.
Sugar Ray, one of them.
and 15 rounds is always a good way of seeing from the man from the boy. I don't care how you look at
okay.
the man from the boy. And it takes when
I hear from you, then I know that's it because, you know, I wasn't a boxer. I wasn't, you know, I was an admirer. I got pictures of you in my classroom, you know, from Madison Square Garden, you know, and Camacho and Duran and Sugar Ray and the boy from Detroit, you know.
Hey, Doc, can I say something? Who is this guy, man? I'm jealous of him already. He got more pictures of me of Harold than me. What's up with that?
Just send your email to him, and I'll get it to you tomorrow.
I'm jealous, man.
Nah, hey, I'm going crazy with Hal Weston and you on there, man. You know, but let me stop talking. Continue on, bro.
Yeah, but I just think that, you know, if the numbers, you know, I'm excited that the parents are getting involved with their kids and everything, but they're taking it to the extreme now. That's the crazy part about it. I mean, they just going overboard with the, you know, with their kids at the game and dealing with the referees and dealing with the coaches and everything. That's the sad part about the whole thing. And pushing their kids into sports is the other sad part. They should always let their kids want to play sports, not push them into make them play sports.
Because it should always be fun, Harold. It should always be fun for the kids. They should want to play and not have to be pushed into playing. And by the way, if the parents actually sat down and thought about it, Harold, I don't have to tell you this, the odds of their kid becoming a professional athlete are somewhat minuscule to begin with.
That's the sad part. The sad part isn't that they're being pushed. It isn't that they're having their kids chase it. The sad part is they have no idea just how significant the odds are against your kid even getting a scholarship, much less going to sign some contract, much less signing a multi-million-dollar contract. The LeBron James of the world are too few.
Much less a full scholarship.
Exactly. Guys, less than 5% of kids will get any money to college. Less than 5% of high school varsity athletes will get dime one of scholarship money.
Isn't it less than 1% of
that's at the college level. At the college level. At the college level, I think you got only it gets to be even less.
No, yeah, the numbers are this, guys. The numbers are this. Less than 5% will even make a college team.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 1% will receive any scholarship money.
Correct.
Much less full scholarships. Those
correct.
Are the facts.
Now, Lady A is a former, she got full scholarship to play collegiate basketball, and without an injury, she would have been a WNBA player. So she definitely understands what Tony is talking about. And it's just amazing, the stats. And once again, the Doc Stanley Sports Network on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports Network, the show. And we thank our special guest, Tony, for joining us as, once again, you're being enlightened here. And, you know, it's in some ways, in a lot of ways, gang, we're talking about the impossible dream. And yet the parents are very naive. You know, they think everybody on television, you know, has made it. Everybody on television, it just happened to be good enough to make the pros, and people really don't understand the, as Mel Cosell said, the astronomical number of people who just don't make it. I mean, you know,
you might as well be trying to hit the lottery, that's what the odds are like. You might as well be trying to hit the lottery. I think the odds are akin to that. I mean, the reason that these athletes make this huge money is because they do what very few people in the world can do. Very few people can consistently hit a 25-foot jump shot, a dunk basketball, or throw a football 50 yards, or knock people out with their bare hands. Very fine-tuned athletes can do this.
Well, whoever
Anthony,
said that is absolutely
right. You know something, if it wasn't for the parents, we would never have a Cal Ripken, or we would never have a
Ken Griffey Jr.
Most of Ken Griffey Jr. So, you know, sometimes when do you stop? When do you say, hey, listen, when does a parent shouldn't push his kid?
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't want anybody to answer that because if parents ever decide to behave, then I'm out of a job. coaches learn how to behave, I'm out of a job.
You're right,
can
man.
I pose a question to Mel?
Yeah.
He brought up a good point about the athletes and different things. I mean, you look into the area of professional wrestling as well. I mean, people look at a lot of the wrestlers in, like, say, for instance, the WWE, and they think just because they're on TV, they make millions of dollars. But
or even a good point you bring up, see, they think it's fake.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
let me say this,
millions of dollars, but isn't it a very few of the top wrestlers that actually make?
Very few. A minuscule amount, see. And by the way, the WWE, to a professional wrestler is what Broadway is to a professional, a singer, or actor, or dancer. It's the big time. It's it. You're there. You have arrived, if you will. Most of the wrestlers work in tiny little independent shows and little nondescript cities and counties trying to make enough to eke out a living. You know, most of the wrestlers see and in panel when we first start out in this business, man, you were staying in a hotel room with 3, 4, or 5 guys just like you, trying to have somebody from the big federations notice you and hopefully give you a look. So that's what people don't understand, man, that this is much like being a very struggling actor trying to make your way. It's brutal. It's brutal. You're trying to get seen. You're trying to get some recognition. And at the same time, the real pain that is involved in what's done to your body is absolute brutality.
Hey, can I say something? Can I get back to Jeremy Lin for one thing that I think is my show is on Saturday mornings, and I talked about this just yesterday, and what I said is what a lot of people are missing is what Jeremy Lin brings, from my perspective, talking to the parents and the coaches of the younger guys, the lesson everybody lost from this guy is you never give up because you never know when you're going to get your shot, and when you do, you better be ready. And that's the one thing this kid did that everyone's losing sight of. You know how hard it is to stay in the game and on top of your game when you've been waived twice, and the only reason you're playing is because the two superstars are hurt, and this guy stepped up and immediately had impact. That's what I'm telling my kids, and that's what I'm telling other parents to tell their kids.
Don't forget he's got a Harvard education.
Hey, my brother.
Ain't no dummy. That's the same way with Bruce from the
check
Giants.
It out. They talked about Jeremy Lin, right? John, I'm down here in Florida. Real quick, I go to NewYorkTimes.com. John Starks, you guys know about him, you know.
Yeah. Hey, that's my guy, John Starks.
Bad guy.
Great guy, by the way. Great guy.
This guy says, hey, man, I'm behind Jeremy Lin because he's just like me. He was an unknown.
More than that, John Starks was actually packing groceries, okay?
Yeah, he was
playing
groceries.
In the D-League and packing groceries, all right?
The point that Tony brought up. Hold on a second, Anthony. The point that Tony brought up is one. They said that Winston Churchill one time was the speaker at a college, and he got up, but he simply said, never give up, never, 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 never give up. And I just thought that was apropos when Tony said how Lin stayed prepared, never gave up, and then the opportunity came, and the rest, they say, is history.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like...
You know, that's the culture of the Asian. I mean, that's the belief that they have all the time, is never give up, if you know about the history of them, because that is their whole motto, is never, never give up. And that's something that my father always taught me and put installed in me. Don't ever give up, regardless.
Hey,
and that's
Malcolm
what I tell
said,
people, how far would you go? When I talk to guys in the boxing ring, they ask me, say, how far would you go? I say, I would die. And when person hears that, then they get nervous.
Who's that talking? who was that talking? Was that Harold Weston?
Harold Weston Jr. African American matchmaker at Madison Square Garden.
Hey,
the first major beat to enter Fremont.
Hell, you're on my man, boy.
The first man to beat Vito Antifermo. Harold Weston was a little butterball in the military.
See,
and somebody dared him. And he
Harold don't remember me, man. I got a picture with Harold.
And beat Vito Antifermo and became the first ever African matchmaker in history. Madison Square Garden was the man who, Angelo Dundee, we talked about last week, came over after Harold had beat up on one of his fighters and told him what everybody knew or would know, that Harold Weston was a great, great fighter.
It's all about heart, Doc.
Know,
it really is, especially when it comes to John.
Brief,
people like
that
him.
Story that you told me that about Harold Weston when he went to another country to fight. And
Harold tells the story. Harold said he when he went into the ring, there's two stories. Harold noticed that the referee looked familiar. And when Harold got into the ring, he started jabbing and hooking. The referee came over to him. No. You can't be throwing jabs and hooks. So then when Harold started blocking the punches, the referee said, No. You can't deflect the punches either. And when Harold sat in the corner, it came to me. He said, "Oh, okay, I remember. This guy is the commissioner." He was the boxing commissioner who had something on the fight and was telling Harold to show no offense or no defense. Harold fought in France. And was so magnificent that he heard this sound and this noise coming in the ring, and he turned around and he turned to his late father, Harold Weston Sr., and the great trainer, Gil Clancy, said, "What's that?" And they looked. They were throwing money in the ring. They were applauding Harold for a massive performance. And Harold turned to Gil, and his dad said, "Well, ain't that my money? Let's get it." And they said, "No, Harold, let's get out of here." But just a display of it. I mean, all you had to know was that the likes of Ray Charles Leonard wouldn't fight him. And he drew against Wilfred Benitez in the fight at Madison Square Garden, and many thought he won. And then he had a 12-round split decision loss to Benitez when Benitez became the youngest man to ever win a world championship, beat Combalé, and then he beat Carlos Pellegrino for the world championship.
His name was Antonio Cervantes from Colombia.
Who Lady A, who ducked my man. Hey, Tony, you know.
Oh,
Lady
my
A,
God. Where were you the other day, man, with this guy with Duran, man? You missed it.
So all I want to.
Tyro, he couldn't deal with it. I told him he had a man crush on him to stop.
Everybody knows, you know, it's amazing that Lady A, you of your class and character, would dispute. I think the greatest Latin fighter, and Harold always talked about him in positive natures. And we, in memory, talking about Roberto, we want to remember our good friend Tito Del Rosario, who grew up in Panama with Roberto. We lost him last March, and as we know, we lost Whitney Houston last week, and before that, we had the same week, same day, we lost Don Cornelius. And one of the great trainers of all time, Angelo Dundee. You know, the roll call continues. Gary Carter, Hall of Fame catcher, one time the highest paid player in baseball. I thought he was the guy that should win MVP the year that they won the World Championship. But
championship,
I don't know how
yeah.
Mike Smith got it. But you know, Mike Smith became the first, if I'm clear, he became the first player that wasn't a Yankee to win three MVPs. Joe DiMaggio was the first. Barrow was the second. And Mickey Mantle was the third of the Yankees to win MVPs three times. Mantle won a few plays to win it back-to-back. They did a field setup. If you went on the outfield, Roger Maris in right field, he won it back-to-back. Mickey Mantle in center field won it back-to-back. Ernie Banks at shortstop. Joe Morgan at second base. First base was Lou Gehrig. I think it might have been Jimmy Fox. Behind the plate was Yogi Berra. I don't know if a third baseman ever won it back-to-back. I don't think Smith won back-to-back, but he may have. But Yankees, though, just have dominated. In fact, New York City at one time just dominated the whole baseball world. I mean, there were years where I think it had a 10-year span where a New York team was in the World Series, and six of those times it was New York teams against each other. And in that whole 10-year span, somebody from New York City was the MVP. Doc Stanley Sports Death on the Blake.
And the Yankees don't have a black manager. Just to be on the safe side with that.
Well, we're not going to deny that it's there. I mean, the Yankees were next to the last team to get a black player. Elson Howard, 1955, and supposedly
number 32.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing you say that because in 1963, when he became the first African American to win the MVP in the American League, that was the year of 32, where Sandy Koufax won the MVP in the National League. He was number 32.
Yeah.
And Jim Brown won the MVP in the NFL. He was number 32.
Mel, everybody knows that Elston played center field because Yogi was still behind the plate because his position was a catcher.
No, he played left field. He played left field.
But
Cleet Boy once told me that had there been no Yogi Berra, Elston Howard would have been a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
So, yet. You know, there was things here. Doc Stanley,
his wife, you know,
place,
you know, you told right out there, his wife had that book. It's called Elston and Me. His wife wrote that book. He should have been the first black manager in baseball, but Frank Robinson got the position because he died.
Really? Well, you know, Frank, it's amazing that thing about Larry Doby.
Okay.
I've got a long list here, so anybody that wants to jump in, let me know. You know, it's amazing. Larry Doby was the second African-American in Major League Baseball, and ironically, Larry Doby was the second African-American manager in Major League Baseball, but Doby was the first African-American to ever lead the league in home runs and the RBIs, and he was the first African-American to win a World Series, as in 48. When he went to the World Series with the Cleveland Indians.
Right.
Made story. Right. We got a long list here of groups. If anybody have questions you want to shoot out, we've got you. And we really want to thank Tony for joining us. With Danny Skiles brought him here. Looking for Dusty, but Dusty still hasn't seemed to be able to join us yet. But, okay, gang, we know we've got Tony here. It's an amazing thing. He's talking about the pressures. And you know, that was one thing John McEnroe talked about, that as a kid, that his parents never pushed him in any direction. You know, he said he tried football and he got tackled a couple of times. He said, you know, this ain't going to work. And he also said, you know, he really never wanted to play a sport that wasn't a team-orientated sport. He wanted to be part of a team. But it turned out, I think, for my money, he's the best all-around tennis player we've ever had, the Sugar Ray Robinson of tennis. Real quickly, some things happened last night. Klitschko,
oh my God,
retained his heavyweight championship of the world. Today, the Knicks, Jeremy Lin and all, beat the world champion Dallas Mavericks.
Yeah, man. I watched that game with my father.
Doc, don't forget about Paul Williams won.
Doc, can we talk about Chris Arriola's comments or no?
Yeah, go ahead. Talk about it.
After his win last night, after the interview, did you watch it or no?
Well, give it to us.
Did you watch it last night or no? The fight with Arriola. Arriola.
No. That didn't
fight. No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, give us a scoop on it.
He cursed out Don King and said Don King was a racist. And then Jim Gray pulled the microphone away from him and said, "We're not going to have that on the show," and he walked off.
Damn.
Well, why was he pissed at DK?
I'm still trying to get to the bottom of that one. I don't know why
because
he said that.
Because he's a fool and he's arrogant and he doesn't know what he's talking about, and that's all he wants.
I mean, you know, no, it's an amazing thing about Don. Doc Stanley, Sports Def on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soda Channel. Sports Def is the show. You know, we're going to take a break, gang. And
all right.
Come right back.
Hey, no, I got to sign
Anthony,
off,
you leaving
man.
Us? Okay, everybody,
everybody
in the panel, really quickly, we want to say late birthday greetings to Chief Petty Officer Nordoff. Everybody tell Anthony happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Anthony, happy birthday, my brother.
Hey,
happy
listen,
birthday.
Man.
I'm
very honored to be with you, to listen to you guys talk, because, you know, I'm down here in Florida, and I've been down here for almost 20 years, but I'm born and raised in New York, and especially Howard Weston. Yeah, that was my idol, man. You know, Howard was a bad boy.
All right, it's over, Harold. I'm officially jealous. Harold.
Yeah, it's all right, but, like, I ain't see Harold. Like,
you
got to
worry about that, lady, eh?
Anthony, before you go, I want to thank you for your service to our country.
No. Hey, Harold, you were a nasty brother, bro. Let me tell you something, man. You know, I'm 60, but, like, I know how you used to roll with that uppercut and that jab, boy. You were nasty, man, and, you know, I tried.
Miles Davis told him.
Hey, Hal, I try and still do it now.
But anyway, Miles Davis had told him had he had a punch. You know, it was Art Russ that introduced Harold Weston to Miles Davis. And dovetailing what you said, Anthony, Miles is such a fan of Harold. He told Harold, whenever you fight, call the office and leave four tickets when you're going to be fighting.
Hey, Harold.
Yeah.
You threw them punches so quick. You ain't had to hit them hard. You had to figure out the hell you was doing. Shit. You ain't got to hit nobody hard. You just hit them fast and just move to the side and say, hey, how did that feel? Anyway, listen, I'm signing off, Hal, man. Hey,
right, man.
I hope I see you in New York one day, man.
No, I'll be down in Florida. I'm doing some shows down there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I just came back about a month ago. I was down there in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Yeah, I was down there in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah, Hollywood, yeah. I'm in Tampa.
Oh, okay, all right.
But just let Mel know, man, and, you know, wherever you at, I'll come and see you, man. I got pictures of you, bro.
Okay, I'll do that, man. When I come, I'm gonna be coming down there in about another 3 more weeks. I guess I'm getting ready to put a show down there.
All right, but then let Mel know when I come down and meet you, bro.
Okay, I'll do that, and thanks a lot.
I love you, Hal, man. You were great, bro. You were great, bro.
Thank you. Hope we have some more great days.
And tell that sister, man, she good too, boy. She taught you. She know her stuff too.
All right.
Anthony, take care, guys. Bye bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Time for a break, gang. We'll be right back as we continue on Sports in Depth on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul Channel Sports Network Show. Fox Stanley, Sports in Depth on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul Channel Sports in Depth is the show.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
It's a Sunday night on Sports in Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul, the channel, Sports Network, the show. The Knicks have won again. And talk about Miles Davis in the background, a little Miles Davis here music, as we remember Black History Month and salute some of the great jazz artists, Miles Louis Davis, born in St. Louis, Louis Armstrong, Pops, J.J. Johnson, considered by Leroy Neiman the greatest trombone player of all time. Cannot forget the likes of Benny Goodman, for it was Benny Goodman who was the first band leader to integrate his band when he brought his drummer in. Tony Bennett, discovered by Pearl Bailey and a tremendous artist in his own right. And Ella Fitzgerald, amazing story about Ella Fitzgerald. Ella Fitzgerald was a dancer. She became the first ever woman to win the talent show Amateur Night at Chipolo Theater, and it was kind of ironic because she was a dancer, and the girl before her was so outstanding that Ralph Cooper turned to her and said, "You know, honey, I don't think you can top that. You know, can you sing?" She went out and sung for the first time, and was discovered that same night, so much like Whitney Houston when she was discovered by Clive Davis, by Chick Webb, and the rest is history. In fact, Chick Webb was her first husband. Doc Stanley, Sports and Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soda Channel, Sports and Depth is the show. And I've got a horde of numbers. Okay, I know my group enough. If you're not part of the panel and you have a question,
I have a question.
You're part of the panel, lady.
I have a question anyway. I don't care.
Calm,
I want to be heard.
Calm down, lady. You know.
I have a question.
What we have, if anybody is not part of the panel, if you call in and listening, if you want to listen, fine. If you want to ask a question to anybody, please feel free. And Tony, we're just elated to have you here. Danny Scouts here. Lady, hey, take it away. What do you got there, lady?
Yeah, I got a question for Harold. Harold, who is this guy? I got pictures. I got pictures of you, Harold. I can't wait to see you, Harold. What's up with that?
Listen. Cut the jealousy.
I'm
okay?
Jealous, Harold. Very officially.
Hey, I got fans.
Hey, Doc, can I pose a question
to
Harold Weston?
Hey, was it the Harold Weston show?
It seems that way. Am I the only guy that met Hal?
No, I want to pose a question to him.
Hey, Tony, I'm jealous, man. Tony, I'm jealous, man.
Hey, Lady A, you know what? I got to ask you, where did you play your high school ball, Lady A?
I played at Martin Luther High School.
All right.
And where'd you go to college at?
66th Street in Amsterdam.
LIU.
Mm-hmm. I would have thought you were Christ the King girl.
No, you can't. I leave that for Shamika Holdsclaw and all those other girls, like Sue Bird, man.
Hey, Doc, if I may, Harold, like he spoke about, you know, the new fighters today and the lack of discipline, the lack of training. What's your outtake on last night's post-bout brawl between Derek Chisora? And David Haye. I mean, is that something that always happened in boxing to boost up, or is just a lack of discipline with these fighters nowadays?
Oh, my goodness.
What it is basically this guy is trying to make a name for himself and trying to be the bad boy of boxing. You know, see, the only way you can be a bad boy, you got to win the fight, okay? That's the only way you can be a draw. You can't lose the fight and still try to be the bad boy because you've been exposed. And my point is that this guy is trying to boost the fight up and trying to think he's the baddest guy on the planet by smacking the champ and all that. Yeah, and trying to make some kind of scene like he want everybody to get to know who he is. But he failed. He failed, and that's the fact of it. And so I didn't even see the fight. I ain't even got to see the fight because I know he can't fight. I know he can't fight. I haven't seen an American heavyweight yet that can fight yet. But my point is that's all he's trying to do. He's just trying to be one on the outside of boxing where he wants people to recognize him if he can fight and try to boost the gate up. But he failed.
You know, I'll tell you this, though, C. Wayne's. I'll tell you this. I mean, I saw the fight, and with all, you know, although Harold is saying, you know, pretty much everything that I agree with, I just have to say this. For a guy that approached a Klitschko fight the way he did, I saw him fight a lot better than most guys that fight Klitschko. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah.
Just from that fight last night, I think that kid, that Del Boy.
That's the case, then how did he lose?
I'm just saying. You know what, Harold? What I'm saying is that the way he approached the fight was a lot better than when most guys would have fought. The way that the tact, in other words, the strategy that they would have used to try to beat him. I mean, I'm not saying that he's all of that as a boxer. I'm just saying that the strategy.
But he put on a better quality fight.
Correct, compared to what most people try to do. When they fight the Klitschko's. That's what I'm saying.
Well, hey, this guy looked better against Klitschko because you're used to seeing guys who not only are too small for Klitschko, but have lousy technique to boot, a.k.a. David Haye.
Well, the strategy that he was using, trying to come inside and hitting him to the body, like I don't know if you saw a couple of times, he was hitting him with some real good left hooks to the body. You know, I got to tell you this. I feel like that strategy works a lot better than guys trying to go toe-to-toe with him and getting nailed with a 1-2 and a jab.
Toe-to-toe's not totally bad, but how to tell you, Lady A, okay, and anybody else, I'm sure, that, you know, when you get inside against a big dude like Klitschko, who's like 6'7", about 250, man, when you get inside, like you said, you got to let your hands go, man.
Right,
you can't be standing around like you're playing a chess match with those guys. When you get inside, you got to let your hands go.
Right. You know,
well, the sad part, these guys don't know how to do that. And that's
Harold. Harold, it's like you say all the time, they got one strategy. Harold, how many times haven't you said half these guys only have one strategy, one approach, and then when they're exploited, they have nothing else?
Yeah, so this is the problem. That's the reason why the trainers are bad today. That's the bottom line.
But I remember Harold. I remember, since we're talking, let's do some black history real quick. Joe Louis was the second African-American to be heavyweight champ of the world. He held the title longer than anybody else, 12 years. One of his tribulations, though, in getting the fight against Braddock is he had to give back 10% of his purchase for the first 10 years of his career. Jack Johnson, December 26, 1908, became the first African-American ever to win the heavyweight championship of the world. Floyd Patterson, when he beat Ingemar Johansson in the third fight, became the first fighter to ever win the heavyweight championship of the world again. He already had became the youngest heavyweight champion in the history of boxing, and that was supplanted by another young man from Brooklyn by the name of Mike Tyson, who became the youngest heavyweight champion in the history of boxing, all part of our Black History Month salute, as Muhammad Ali became the first man to win the title three times, and Evander Holyfield today is still the only man ever to win the title four times. Sugar Ray Robinson won the welterweight championship. Record of 77-0. Tommy Bell came out that fight 78-0. Didn't lose his first fight until he lost to Jake LaMotta, which made him then 94-1. He fought LaMotta again the same month after taking up a tune-up. He left that month 96-1, and when he retired the first time, Walker Smith Jr. from Black Bottom, Detroit, had a record of 132-2. Doc Stanley Sports and Death on the Blake Radio Network. A little look at Black History Month, as we were talking so much about boxing, and we had to bring those facts up
Joe Louis, Joseph. Actually, think about Joe Louis too. Unknown to a lot of people, though. Joe Louis, like, was the thing of that time. His name was Joe Louis Barrows, and he dropped his last name, so people would know that he was fighting. As the same thing with Sugar Ray Robinson. His real name was Walker Smith Jr. Trained at the Salem Crescent Gym, and one night they needed somebody to fight, and the coach always kept the cards of everybody there. So he said, well, Walker, you want to fight? And he said, yeah, and it worked out for him. It was ironic because the great recording star Ray Charles' real name is Ray Charles Robinson. But when he came on the scene, they said, whoa, whoa, no, Ray Robinson's already taken. You can't use that name. What's your name? Ray, okay, drop the Robinson and use Ray Charles. Now, Sugar Ray Leonard, who went to Ray Robinson and asked her to use the prefix Sugar, is actually named after Ray Charles. Ray Leonard's name is Ray Charles Leonard. That's kind of funny that the real Ray Robinson was Ray Charles, and Sugar Ray Leonard was named after the real Ray Robinson, and he went to Ray Robinson to ask him, could he use the prefix, and they're all connected.
When did he ask him that, Bob?
Supposedly, he said he went to according to the story, that he went to Ray and asked could he use the prefix of Sugar.
I mean, but when did he do that? What year?
I don't know how.
I mean, he won the Olympics, what, in 76, right?
Yeah, well, he was Ray Leonard then.
Okay, and then and so basically he was Ray Leonard. But when did he ask Sugar Ray Robinson? You mean he flew all the way out to Harold?
I'm telling you
California?
What they told me. Now, Harold, if you know differently, could
well,
you
know
could
Ray
you?
Leonard's a liar. You know Ray will lie.
Wait,
see, hey, Ray, I knew I was waiting for that. Yo, you baited him, Harold.
See, that's what's wrong with us now. Today we go, we say things. Where people have lied about it, and we're fooling our young people these false,
Harold,
that's why I say here, that's the truth.
You know, Lady A, pipe down. You say something too, Harold, that Angelo said in his book. I'll never forget it. He said, you know what? He said, Ali always looked out for me, but he said Ray never did. You know, and I remember you. A feather in your cap. You stood up. You stood up when Ray, he dumped Jakes. Remember that?
Right.
Remember that situation?
I mean,
you know, and here's a guy who had been with him from the beginning. Bobby Miles tells stories, too, of, you know, how he kind of lost his memory at certain times when it came apropos.
Oh, my God.
Sports Definitely the Blake, but never Rainbow Soda Channel, Sports Definitely the Show. And this is what I love. You know, here, you hear it first, you hear the facts. It was right here that you heard about Bin Laden being taken down by Sea Wings, the fact that Andre the Giant turned down a pro football contract because he was
Washington
making more
Redskins,
money
as
a wrestler. You know what I mean?
Washington
so,
Redskins.
Yeah, Washington
we wanted
Redskins.
Him badly.
Yeah,
but he was already making over $1 million as a wrestler, so he actually would have had to take a pay cut to play pro football.
That's a million dollars.
Yeah, well, you know what? And the way that guy moved, that pro football career would have lasted about a week and a half.
Really?
Well, you know what they were intrigued about? What they were intrigued with Andre was outside of his humongous size and mass was the idea of a guy that's somewhere around 7'4" and over 450 pounds, close to 500, wondering what the guy could do on the line. They were intrigued by the very thought of it.
Oh, I'm sure they were.
Even Whitfield got drafted in three sports. Hey, you know what? You think that we could still get him on the Jets to help on the offensive line? Because I don't know.
Well, that'd be a tough call based on his being dead.
I'll tell you that.
Too bad, right?
Yeah, absolutely too bad. Listen, I'm a Steelers guy, so I don't care what the Jets do.
Wow. Steelers, okay.
Wow.
Roethlisberger, here we come.
Wow.
Now, I have a quick question for Harold, if I may. I'll try to be brief.
Wait, it's a Harold show tonight.
That's always intrigued me, Harold. And that's this. When Ray Leonard and all those guys, I think the Sphinxes and company, were winning those Olympic golds, I actually thought that Howard Davis was better than Ray. What happened
well,
to him?
Howard
Howard
Davis
he got
was voted as Howard Davis, you're right. Howard Davis was picked as the best fighter of the Olympics. In fact, when Harold, when they were both making crazy money, but Harold, Howard was picked as the top fighter of that whole. We're talking about Ray. We're talking about the Sphinx brother, Leo Randolph, who became a world champion, won a gold medal. He was Howard. How good was Howard?
Howard was all right. His whole problem was that he never changed his whole style from the Olympics. He stayed as a more of an amateur type of situation, and he had bad eating habits. I mean, his eating habits was vegetables. All he wanted, he was a vegetarian, and he just wanted to eat. And I told him he had to eat meat if he's fighting 15 rounds. Because I said when he starts hitting, and that's the point that I like. I said 15 round would definitely show what kind of man you are. Because after he hit that, I tell him, I said, after you hit that 11th round and going down to those last four, you're not gonna have nothing left. And if you don't have nothing in your system and have been eating, like steak and prime rib or something like that in your system, then you're gonna fall apart. He didn't faint on mine. He said, nah, man, I'm a vegetarian. That's all I eat. I said, okay, you'll see. I wish you all the best.
Hey, Harold, do you know of any other fighters who are vegetarians or vegans, Harold? Do you know of any other vegetarian or vegan fighters?
No, not really. None of I have talked to. My point is that, today's time, the fighters ain't as tough as they were before, so, that doesn't make too much difference. You ain't got to eat no food at all today and still win fights, so it don't make no difference.
Were you ever in any particular sport, baseball, football?
I was actually, I played baseball in college, and I actually played when I was younger on a very, very serious, Lady A, you guys, I don't know any of you guys hovering around Queens, but I used to play for a group called the Bayside Yankees. It's a nationally ranked program. And,
I heard of them.
Yeah, so I was on the very first national championship team for them. I got a scholarship to college. I was a shortstop. I was actually a pretty good baseball player.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, you watch boxing. You have any thoughts on the fight game?
You know what? I got to tell you, I'm not a big fight guy, and it's I was actually very fortunate to meet a lot of serious fighters when I was younger. I had a good buddy who was in the fight game, and so I got to meet guys like Hector Camacho before he got big. I got to meet and shake hands with the great Emil Griffith. And a bunch of other, so I was around it a whole bunch. It just never struck me personally as something that I got impassioned about. So I got to tell you, I'm not a big proponent of the fight game. It's just not my thing.
And it's funny,
Hey, Doc,
I got
a quick question for Tony, Doc. Let me ask him a quick question. Hey, Tony, when you were playing baseball, can you tell me approximately? Just give me something in the neighborhood. It doesn't have to be exact. How hard was the hardest guy? How hard throwing was the hardest guy you ever faced? Was it in the 80s, the 90s?
I faced guys who threw mid-90s when I played. Like I said, this was a nationally ranked program. I played against Ken Griffey Jr. when I was a kid. I played with guys who went on to play in the major leagues. I don't know if you guys remember that whole Bronx crew, Pedro Bobon Jr., Victor Garcia, Clifford Gonzalez, and those boys. When we were all juniors in high school, we were put on an elite team, and we went to go play colleges like Georgetown, George Washington, and Maryland, and we did very, very well. So I'm probably the only one of that whole crew that never got to play pro ball, but I played against some very, very serious competition.
Well, Tony, how much harder does it take to stand up there with a piece of wood in your hand facing a guy throwing 90-mile-an-hour bullets?
Short answer is it depends how good his curveball is. But, it's just like anything else, and that's why I'm so hard on parents about those who have aspirations for kids to play in the major leagues. I was a nationally ranked player in college, and I didn't even get a look-see in the draft. I was in the top 20 in batting average and the top 10 in RBIs and Division II players across the country, and not even a look-see. And like I said, all the guys I played with, a whole bunch of them went on to play in the majors. So, the odds are so far stacked against you. But to answer your question, first time I saw somebody throwing over 90, I don't think I spent a whole lot of time in the batter's box that particular at bat. But you learn, just like anything else, you learn how to handle it. I think I cried and called my mom from Maryland that first at bat. But you do get used to it. It's like standing in the ring with someone who really knows what they're doing. If you're going to take that sport serious, you better learn quick.
Tone, I once saw Goose Gossage at the Big Ball Yard in the South Bronx, as the late, great Arthur George West Jr. used to say. Hey, Tone, I once saw Goose Gossage strike the side out on 9 pitches. Nothing less than 98 miles an hour in that set.
Well, not only did that man throw hard, he had what, you know, if you know anybody who plays baseball, there's something called a heavy fastball, and not many guys in the history of the game threw as heavy a fastball as Goose Gossage. And
yeah,
with all arms and legs coming at you before you see anything, that's scary.
Yeah, Gary Carter talked about how Gooden threw a heavy fastball and how he used to have extra protection in the catcher's mitt because of not only the velocity but the impact that Doc had when he would catch it. You know, Doc
and a movement, and a movement. Don't forget.
He had nasty movement. Nasty movement. I mean, there were so few of them. I mean, Nolan Ryan was another one. Jeff Torborg used to catch him, and, you know, he would go through, in the course of a season, 3 or 4 catcher's gloves catching Nolan Ryan because that's just how heavy the man's fastball was.
Yeah.
So
Nolan Ryan, who has the second highest percentile of being elected to the Hall of Fame.
Hey, Tony, I got a question for you.
Yeah,
hold
Lady
on,
A.
Lady A. Oh, let's finish this thought now. Only surpassed the fact is ironic that the two highest percentile of elected voters into the Hall of Fame are both former New York pitchers, you know, and Nolan Ryan is number 2, and the number 98.7. I don't understand how Mays, Aaron, Kamini, Mantle, I mean, Joe DiMaggio didn't get in on the first ballot. But
look at
our
skin, that'll tell you why.
Huh?
Look at their skin, because that'll tell you why they got the highest vote, percentage vote.
Danny, now you're screaming over there. I remember Bill Shannon said something. The late great Bill Shannon said, you know, that there was really some questions about how Willie Mays didn't get in unanimous. That was just, you got to look at it. It's no question.
Well,
about
listen,
it.
The greatest right-handed pitcher didn't get in right away is Juan Marichal. Look, it took him like about 70 years.
I think Juan was a second or third ballot. There were some questions about they were hoping that they wouldn't hold that Rosberg incident against Matt Marichal. Staggering numbers, 244 complete games, and the guy won 243 games. He had a 6-year period. He had a 7-year period where he won 20 games 6 times, and you know, he told a story when we were at the bat day, and I asked him, you know, where'd you get that big high kick from? And he said, you know, I was a sidearm pitcher. And one of my coaches took me on the side and said, hey, you know what, you ought to learn to throw overhand because if you throw sidearm, left-handed pitchers are going to hit you. And he said the only way he could throw the ball overhanded was he had to have that kick. And the rest, they say, is history. Danny, are you still with us? You got some thoughts or questions here or something you want to say?
Well, that's what I wanted to get the point across, is that there is racism. There's still going to be racism in sports. And, you know, the guy is not there. The petty office is not there anymore. He wants to make it sound like everything's all honky-dory, that everything's going to be fine. It's not.
No, well, yeah, but we're talking about stuff that happened in the 60s and 70s. I think we've come a long way.
Well, you heard what happened, what I told you about Ryan Braun a couple of months ago. What happened then?
Aren't they still investigating Braun?
Well, but they haven't suspended him yet.
But how can you suspend him if you're still doing an investigation?
He was caught guilty. They didn't investigate Manny Ramirez, they didn't investigate anybody. They just said,
Danny, you bring up a point. I mean, you know, they had that. I remember Eddie Murray, my friend told me that they had a list. And now, you know, Tony, we look back at that list, and it's ironic that all the names that leaked up that list were minorities. Barry Bonds got blackballed. I mean, Barry has still maintained his innocence. The United States government went after his train, locked the train up, went after his trainer's wife and mother-in-law. And you mean to tell me that you know, in Barry's last 2 years, nobody could take. And here's the perfect point: how does two pitchers wind up with the highest votile in the history of the Hall of Fame, as if Willie Mays was chopped liver, as if Hank Aaron never existed. I mean, I would even have a problem if it was Joe DiMaggio. But how do two pitchers, dependent upon their teammates, get the highest? I mean, how did Willie Mays not go unanimous? Willie Mays is the only home run hitter in the history of baseball to ever lead the league in stolen bases. Okay, he has the all-time putouts for an outfielder. He led the league in stolen bases, batting average. I mean, you know, Tony, I mean, maybe because you don't think that way, but it's obvious. I mean, we have less black players in baseball today than we had 20 years ago.
Hang on a second, because you bring up a very good point. First of all, at the time, there was a ton of racism in sports. At the time.
Really?
Now, you talk about how there are fewer black players in the game today. You remember one of the all-time great role models of any era, Hank Aaron. Hank Aaron said something a couple of years ago that drove me nuts. And he said something along the lines of, there are too few black players in the game, and we got to get them back. Let me ask you this. Short, fat, big-nosed Italian guy, Tony Fiorino, comes out and says, at the time when there was a majority of black players and Hispanics, if I were to come out and say, there are too few white players, and we got to get them back, are you kidding me? I'd have been fired from my job.
You're right.
No, you're right. No, you wouldn't. I mean, the situation is, the bottom line is that white players will never have a problem getting into the baseball. I mean, Dusty Baker told a great story about, you know, they do these stories about where are the black managers, he said, and then nothing happens. I mean, I tell you something, you know, you talk about that. I mean, there are very few black sports writers that cover baseball. Because they won't give them the job. They're very few
there's
black
two,
sports
there's
writers.
There's only two of them that I
that's
see
it.
Every day at the press
conference.
And then I remember Dick Edwards told me, and I know personally of how the Yankees and the Mets systematically delete the black media. I mean, out of you know, you can't get credentials. Even today, I've heard that there's only one African-American paper that has a season credential to cover the New York Knicks, who was one time called the New York Knickerbockers.
I don't mean to laugh, but let me explain to you something.
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, I'm glad you said that, even though I don't think that way, because between you and me, if you can write a hell of a column, I don't care what color you are. If you can manage,
Tony, you are the exception, not the rule. I mean,
that might be an overstatement.
Well, no, you are the exception, not you, Bill Shannon, Dave Anderson, George Vesey, Peter Vesey.
Yeah.
You know, the exception.
But,
I mean, you know,
Doc,
but
with the exception of Willie Randolph, tell me the last high-profile guy that was really a shoe-in to become a manager in the major leagues who was black who got passed over.
But all you have to do is Casey Stengel proved with a good team, that's it. He was a clown before he came to the Yankees, and he was a clown when he went to the Mets. Casey didn't win nothing. Well, hey, there was questions about
Listen,
the Yankees
Tony
taking
Pena
Joe Torre.
Tony Pena hasn't gotten a job. Tony Pena hasn't gotten a job, and he was manager of the year.
Cito Gaston won back-to-back World Series, and they made Cito the batting coach. Chris Chambers was right there. I remember Audrey Chambers told me, you know, Chris and Willie were right there, but they got rid of Chambers got fired as the batting coach of the world champion. How do you get fired as the batting coach of the world champion? What'd you do wrong? Did hit the
you work for Steinbrenner. That's what you do.
You know what? You know, you said something about Steinbrenner, and you were there with me, Danny, when we asked Rafael Santana, what was the climate like in being a Yankee and a Met? He said, in the Yankees, you know, Tony, you bring up a point. He said, you always felt that there was a microphone behind the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But Audrey Chambers said Willie and Chris were deleted because the Yankees didn't want Joe Torre to step down and these guys get the job by process of elimination. I mean, it's a sad. We're in the 21st century and America has a black president and the Yankees are not even remotely thinking about getting a black player. There's no more third base coach. I mean, that was a big. I mean, it's the same. It's a sad commentary. A third base coach. I mean, is a problem getting a third base coach? And these guys, what do you interview for a manager job? You don't even know who's going to be in your staff. I mean, and here's a sad commentary too. And it shows how did Gerard, who got fired, okay, whose team was a second division team, get manager of the year over Willie Randolph, who took his team
That's
to the
right.
title. Took his team to the title. Joe Girardi got manager of the year and was fired, had a problem with management, and had a second division team. He got MGR. 1954. How does Yogi Berra win MVP? How does Yogi Berra win MVP when the Cleveland Indians ran away with the pennant? Bobby Avello won the batting title.
Let's talk about Albert Bell. You remember Albert Bell? He never got the MVP. Should have gotten the MVP.
I mean, if people say, well, his attitude. Listen, the first guy voted in the Hall of Fame was Tyrus Raymond Cobb, a devout racist, no member of the Ku Klux Klan. Opposition didn't like him. Henny Hillman said that when Cobb, the year he stole 96 bases, he said he would have stole 100. But every time he got a jump on the ball, I fouled it off. But Cobb was and here's a guy who, when they roomed him with Babe Ruth, came down and told the guy in charge of the face, look here, I never ate with a nigga before or slept with him. I'm not going to do it now. Get him out of my room. But Ty Cobb was the first guy voted in the Hall of Fame over Babe Ruth, over Christy Mathewson, over Honus West. First guy voted in. I mean, I go for stature. Pete, Tony, there was a ton before. There's 10 tons now. You know, you look at pro football. I mean, we've got more African American coaches than ever before. But I mean, why does Emmitt Smith have to sit out for a contract and you automatically give Troy Aikman money? I mean, you automatically give Tom Brady money, and when you say it's not the Patriot way, so you don't pay Randy Moss.
Hang on a second. If you're going to compare Brady and Randy Moss, I mean, Randy Moss has been a pariah in every lock, and T.O. has been pariah in every locker room they've gone into color aside.
I've never heard this. Yankees 3, Red Sox 2, Clubhouse 4, Tampa Bay 1. I mean, what are you telling me? You're telling me that psychologically they get into the player's mind? I don't buy that. Nobody's going to tell me, you know what? Fuck Randy Moss. I'm going to ground out the shortstop. I don't want to get hit. Come on.
Well,
it's a proven fact that the Patriots have not been the same team since he left. You know, they don't have the deep threat anymore. All right? Jim Brown. I'll never forget when Jim Brown called Art Modell and said, look, Art, I'm making this movie, and I need a few days. Art said, I can't treat him special.
Yeah.
I mean, how can you not treat Jim Brown special? But now when Joe Namath's making a movie and called the Jets and said, hey, I'll be a few days late. Hey, Joe, no problem. You know, no problem. It's always there.
I think the difference is the guy who doesn't make the concessions is a man of integrity, and the guy who does make the concessions is someone who's not. I mean, it all comes down to how do you treat your star players, and some people will kowtow and do whatever the star player wants, and then there are those. I mean, think about it. I'm a Steelers fan. Think about the people that the Rooney family has let go. Plaxico Burress, Santonio Holmes. And you can make an argument that why have they kept Ben Roethlisberger? I mean, the Rooneys did a good job of identifying some trouble, but you know what? The only thing you have trouble defending is that Ben Roethlisberger is still there. I mean, granted, he's never been convicted of anything, but at the same time, you know, if you're gonna walk the walk, you got to talk the talk when it's time to do so. But I think it's foolish for us to look back at stuff that's happened in the 50s and 60s. You know what I mean? Because everybody knows there was racism
it still back
happens
then. Today. Danny Skiles, want to take over?
Yeah, well, like I just made the point. Ryan Braun and Manny Ramirez, you can pair them together. I mean, why does they knew that he was positive for steroids right away, and they let him keep on playing. Manny, when he got caught, oh, you know what? Well, that's it. You're suspended. You're gone.
Well, what about a strike two, strike three scenario on Manny Ramirez?
No, that's the first time. If you remember the first time that he got caught, the next day, he was suspended. He said, you know what, that's it, you're gone. They didn't let him play. They didn't say, well, you know, let's wait out the season, let's investigate what's going on. No, it just, you know, cut him out the next day. Even with A-Rod, you remember when he got called using steroids, and that was maybe 5 or 6 years before that. They said they had them on a press conference and said,
well,
you don't want...
Here's another thought. And like I said, Mike, you know, you come from a different club. Here's another thought, though. Okay. Barry Bonds has never been proven guilty. Okay. Okay. Mark, I never understood why they dog parked Mark McGwire. He broke the record for rookies home runs, 49. Mm-hmm. Mark hit a ball any ballpark in the world. But Barry Bonds got blackballed out of baseball. Okay. McGwire, known to be
He's a coach. He's the batting coach
of the world champion St.
Louis Cardinals.
He's the batting. Right. Mike. You know, I understand you don't see it, but
Tony. Tony. But and it's not that I don't
see it. I'm sorry, Tony.
That's okay. I think in some ways, listen. Mm-hmm. Do I look to my kids and say Mark McGwire is a hero? No, but I will tell you this. I think Mark McGwire, one of the smartest guys you'd want to meet, because you know what. I think this guy saw what was coming down the pike. Think about it. You don't think he had 3-4 more years left? We could have been making money. I know. We can never prove this. He said, "Hey, this whole steroid thing is blowing up. I'm going to take my single season record. I'm going to turn and run like hell." And that's what gave him the opportunity to say no comment during all the trials.
You know what,
in some ways, the guy was incredibly smart.
I'm going to say something that we heard Bert Flowers on the show one time. And this is because as Art Russ Jr. and Mel Cosell Smith can tell you that it was Art Russ Jr. who first peeped this back in the middle '80s, and he said and steroids were interjected into the game by pitchers, not by everyday players, because I remember Chad Vigenda talked about they had the guys in the bullpen because they didn't want the game in the first place. But my thing, first of all, the ability to play the game, steroids, what I understand. It only helps the body recuperate faster. But Bert Flowers said stuff that was comical and maybe true. He said, if everybody is doing it, then who's cheating?
Well, not everybody is doing it, and that's the problem. say whatever you want. Just because, no, but here's the thing. And there was a study done where they told high school players, and they said, if there was a magic pill that we could give you that would ensure you get a scholarship, but it's going to take 10 years off your life, would you do it? And almost unanimously they said yes, because kids at that age, they don't understand long-term consequences, and they don't understand that they're not invincible. You ask a 44-year-old man, I'm going to give you a pill that's going to give you $1 million, but it's going to give you 1 year less with your kids, and they're all going to tell you, go to hell, I'm not taking it. That's one of the problems. You got those kids that all they're thinking is short-term. And that's why there has to be stringent rules in place for this substance abuse, because if there's one guy who's playing clean, they all got to play clean, period. Mm-hmm. Because
the
right, by the way,
came out with steroids, and they made a whole big fuss about steroids because that white kid up in Ohio got died, took an overdose. That's the only reason why they came out with it. If not, we wouldn't even know about steroids.
Are you kidding me? Lyle Alzado, back in the 70s, the guy died a young man because he destroyed his body with steroids.
Yeah, but they never made anything in the NFL about it. They didn't have
Danny, you're right. They turned a blind eye, but it's been around forever. I mean, that's just the reality.
Now we know, but I'm saying is that when a white guy takes steroids and he overdoses, you know what? We got to do something about it.
No one really ever dies of an overdose of steroids. It's from the symptoms and the side effects.
Yeah, it's a long-term
use.
Yeah.
From the long-term use
it's
of,
like,
of
well,
steroids.
Your vital organs.
You know?
Now, Lady A is right. There's
nobody,
a long-term degradation that happens.
Right,
Lady A is 100% right.
Okay.
It's a long-term degradation. It causes a lot of your internal organs to shut down. And one other thing not just about a quick recovery. It does make you stronger. That's a fact.
Tony,
it's funny you said that. You said it makes you stronger. Because I remember they asked Dusty about a certain player. You know, did he think he was? I said, Dusty, you know, do you think so and so is taking steroids? And he said, you ever known a person get older and hit a ball further?
Exactly. It makes you stronger, but you know what? You still got to be able to hit a baseball, and that's what you were alluding to earlier. But I wonder what Lady A was going to say.
But what I was going to say was that a lot of times people have this fallacy about steroids, and they fail to realize that. Okay, we could sit here and talk about, all right, this guy overall 10 years is going to take 10 years off your life, but it's not something that's, number one, that's going to come immediately. So you have to do prolonged use to get use out of it.
Wow.
Number two is that the side effects are the side effects are detrimental because of the fact that, you know, with guys, you're talking like, you know, testicular shrinkage, you got acne, you got baldness, you got, and not only that, but it's water weight. You retain water. So now your bones become brittle, just like the guy that I told you guys threw the baseball and broke his arm.
Yeah, right.
Okay?
Pitcher.
When he was pitching, okay? These are all things that come with steroid use. But it's over prolonged time that you start seeing, you know, the side effects and the symptoms really kick in. Like in Lyle Zetti's case, he died of a brain tumor.
And I believe the Baseball Players Union just this year, to my knowledge, last season, I believe, finally gave the okay and consent to
Major League Baseball
to be tested. Yeah, Doc. I think that they finally, I was just about to say, and I just lost my train of thought so quickly.
Whatever happened to
just gave consent to be tested for human growth hormone.
Right.
HGH.
Doc, is Giambi still playing?
Who?
I think he's
still playing.
He had
to use his steroids, and look, nothing happened to him.
Giambi and Pettit fessed up the steroids.
Pettit fessed up to HGH.
Okay. What's the difference, Tony?
It's just different. I'm not a doctor, but HGH is one thing that won't even show up on a steroid test. It's just totally different. They can't even get an accurate test for HGH, yes, and that's why there's a big problem with it.
So that's good to know.
Yeah, but you have to look at it, too, because, you know, a lot of times, too, and, you know, you guys, the panel could correct me if I'm wrong, but even with Olympic testing, how they're able to get a lot of people through the testing and really validate that they have
Can I finish my thought?
What I'm saying is how they're able to validate it is through masking agents. So when they catch you for one substance, 9 out of 10 times they could kind of identify the fact due to the fact that you were taking masking agents that you were taking something else.
You're hiding something.
Correct.
Test does is show that you were hiding something. They can't show what you were hiding.
Correct. And that's where the discrepancy takes place.
Listen, Jose Bautista was tested over 15 times this year because of his home run power. How come Ryan Braun wasn't tested? Or how come he was hitting home runs left and right? And you tell me. And last year, in 2010, Jose Bautista was hitting home runs and he was negative. All of a sudden, in 2011, they tested him over 15 times simply because he was hitting home runs. They never tested Braun for
They caught him. They caught him when they did, but they didn't test him as redundantly.
Yeah, but they only tested him once or twice. Once, you know?
They tested
him because that's the obligation in a playoff when you go into the playoff and the team goes to the playoff. They knew that he was shooting up, they were taking steroids. They just let him play, pal. That's any way you could slice it. They let him play. They knew what he was doing.
You know, Danny, good point. C-Wings, how much of a problem is this in pro football, the steroid use?
I mean, they're starting to catch a lot of guys with the banned substance formula, but they're trying to work that into pro football with the standardized testing and stuff like that. But I think you're going to see a lot more people being suspended with that. I mean, that type of sport is more of a brutal sport, I think, more than any other as far as contact sports. But you'll probably see a lot more people getting caught once they incorporate that fully into football. But you don't see it as prevalent at this point, but you do have people that are suspended when they are caught with that.
But do you remember, C-Wings, how bad it was way back when? Like, you saw Brian Bosworth? Remember Brian Bosworth?
Yeah.
And then you see him like 10 years later, you're like, this guy looks like a skull, right? compared to how he looked when he first got in the league, when he was playing for Seattle.
Well, that's what roids do, lady. It speeds up your metabolism. That's why guys look so old and worn.
Yeah, you look like a
shell. After using after a period of time. That's why he looks so old and worn.
The fact is we still don't know. We still don't know enough about what steroids do to our body. Because guess what? There's not enough testing about what it does because it's an illegal substance.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's really what it comes down to. We don't know. These guys who take it even once, we don't know what that does to your body. We really don't.
I think if you really had to do a long-term study, you would have to kind of go back to guys that are still alive and are still doing it. You know what I mean? Because everybody either dies or from extensive use when they've done it for so long. It's probably, especially in wrestling, Mel. I mean, look how many guys have passed away. You know, so it's difficult to have accurate testing because these guys aren't even around anymore, you know? So,
and there's no such thing as adults.
In football, I think, God rest his soul, Lyle Izado will probably be a prime example of the effects of steroids. I mean, I think he was the most prolific one that was an example of what steroids could do to you. And I think Mel Cosell backed me up with this in wrestling. He's still alive, but I seen him probably about 21 years ago. Superstar Billy Graham. He's probably
my all-time favorite wrestler, as a matter of fact. See, my all-time favorite. Tremendous bad guy. Played his villain role to the max. Tremendous performer. But you're right. And do you know where he got the notion to start using? He was one of the final cuts, I believe, on who are the guys in the silver and gold? They're escaping me. The Raiders. I think he was one of the final cuts. And he said during training camp that he put on literally 25 pounds of solid muscle in about a month or so. And after that, he thought the stuff was miracle stuff. I mean, the guy was ripped. When I would see him at Madison Square Garden live in person, him and the very great Bruno Sammartino. And I look at Superstar, and the guy is 6'4", 275, ripped to the nines. But like you said, see, he admitted to steroid use in his career, and it's attacked all of his vital organs. I mean, his heart, his liver,
his hip. He had to get his hip replaced. The guy was walking around WWE events with a cane.
Right.
Indeed, yeah. And not only that, I think he had to wind up getting a toe fuse also.
I think the only guy so far, guys, that I would have to say would be probably the prime best guy to take and use. Not even as an example, but to get through long term testing, find out more about steroids would be Jose Canseco.
Yep,
that would be it.
And he
was
the magic dose.
He thinks he knows
the magic dosage. Yeah,
that's it. Because he's the only guy that I know. I mean, this guy in his book Juiced, like I was saying before, was talking about how they were injecting each other in the Oakland A's locker room and in the Texas locker room. So,
you know, the amazing thing about him, too, though, you talk about him. Doc Stanley Sports Network on the Blake Reader Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports Network for this show. I know you enjoyed it, and I'm listening back as the panel is once again enlightening the world. You know, he was, I remember his MVP year, and for somehow, the rumor, as the great Tim F. Smiley said, the rumor had it, and the fans in Boston kept saying steroids, and Jose in his book said, in a lot of ways, steroid was a Latin thing, which Latin players kind of automatically did and gravitated. You know, it's amazing that he became the first guy to do 40-40 because, you know, the ability to run is somehow, I believe, hampered with steroids. I'm not sure. But, I mean, you know, he did the 42 home runs and 40 home runs. And, you know, it's just amazing that he was the first guy ever in history of baseball. I mean, Willie Mays missed it by two home runs. He did 38 and 40.
Mm-hmm.
He missed two games in 1959, I believe it was. But Jose, 42 and 40. And Jose, I tell you what, lady, you made a good point because he knew how to take it because he was having a year with Boston that he was on route to do 40-40 again.
Right.
And when we talked about it, and he said, I'm going to do 40-40 again. And then as the year got, I said, you know, look 40-40. He said, well, I'm going to do 30-30. But you make a tremendous point that he seemed to not only handle it, but he hasn't had none of the after effects
or none of the degrading things that have happened to, like I said, everybody
else. But interestingly enough, just to piggyback on what you're saying, Doc, this is a guy that had he not come out and said some of the things he said, probably would have not brought some of the main issues about steroids to the forefront that we're looking at today. Obviously, he wrote two books about it. I think he was still in a third book. But, you know, he obviously was saying things that were going on and no one was listening. Until his book came out, it was a controversy where more people more apt to follow up on the story and then pursue it at that point and be like, oh, wow, now look at how many people really are doing this in the sport.
But, Lady A, you know what he did? He did all the things that baseball wasn't doing. Baseball was not testing.
Correct.
He didn't test. He just said, you know, guys, screw it. Here's who's taking it.
Exactly.
And, you know, and granted, he benefited from it greatly while he was taking them and while he wrote about it. But I'll give him credit for the backstabbing SOB that he is.
Right.
He did open our eyes, and he did bring it to the forefront.
How could he be a backstabber?
Hey, Tony, could we
backstabber because he made his baseball career by taking steroids, and he started selling everybody else out, including guys that were playing.
He admitted that he was taking it, so how could he backstab? He goes, listen, I did it so everybody else.
But he was retired at the time. He was selling out guys that were still playing.
That's correct.
That's how he said backs.
Tony, here's a question.
Well, here's a question I have to the panel, and I'm not too sure about this.
Hold on, Steve Wings. Give me 40 seconds, Steve Wings. Hold on. Tony, could that be a problem too with this aggression of parents, this desire to live their dream through their kids, this thing to make sure that my kids are stuff? Is there a minute fear that maybe parents would steer their kids that way?
I could tell you from direct experience that there's a kid I know whose parents knowingly let the kid take steroids when he was in high school.
Oh, my God.
All right, but again, that's a drastic example. But you know what? If it happened once in a small town on Long Island, then I'm telling you it happened somewhere in Minnesota. It happened somewhere in Chicago, in Dallas, in L.A., and anywhere else you can think about it. So these people, these parents who lose perspective, you know, there's no such thing as losing a little perspective. You go off the deep end, and it's letting someone take a test for your kid. It's letting them take steroids.
That's beyond the deep end. That's like seeing Tweety birds. Okay.
Yeah, well, you know what, Lady A, listen to my show. Tune in every once in a while, and you'll hear some crazy stuff that will just blow your mind.
That's disgusting.
You're going to let us know what time your show come on, and if possible, we want you back every week with us. C-Wings, go ahead. You had a question real quick?
No, I wanted to pose this question to the panel at large.
Go ahead.
Have there been any instances of an NBA player being caught with steroids?
Caught? No. No. And by the way, no. But let me explain to you. This is all theory, and we can all chime in on this. There is not as much of a need for that much more strength in basketball. I mean, unless unless they're going to start making four-pointers that you can take from half court, then there's really, like I said, what makes. With the exception of sheer bulk, like a Shaq or Dwight Howard, and these guys are just massive beasts.
Yeah, those guys
beasts.
Were under the boards.
There's no
getting rebounds.
You can put on size, but pure strength. What's going
to
do? It's going to make you shoot the basketball farther? Not really.
You know, first of all, you don't want to be that bulky playing basketball anyway, Doc. You don't really need to bulk up like that.
But
Tony
the point
was
is,
saying.
Making you stronger is really, and even faster. There's not many times that NBA guys are in a full sprint. Think about it. You're dribbling a basketball. You can't go. Nobody runs faster with a ball in their hands than without a ball in their hands. So I don't know if there's necessarily the need for that much more strength and speed. Size, sure, but it ain't muscle size that makes it in the NBA.
Right.
I mean, I could be wrong. That's just my opinion.
I think it's more stamina.
Lady, give me a second. Did Mike Bellamy join us yet?
I guess not.
Okay,
it's more stamina, Doc. I was going to say it's more stamina, too. I mean, you got to be able to run the floor. You know, you got to be able to run from one end.
Too, after a while, it could be very damaging, and you kind of stay in pretty good shape. But now the other thing here too, Lady A, what you got to shoot. Harold, I know boxing had, if I'm correct now, a cocaine problem. Did boxing ever have a steroid problem? I mean, not in your ear, but I mean, you've always been a part of the game as you still are. Boxing had a cocaine problem. Did they ever have a steroid problem, Harold?
Yeah, they talked about the steroid situation back in the Olympics. overseas with I think it was Germany, and they athletes was using steroids in the boxing situation, and that's a coming at one time. They had a little problem with that, and that's the reason why they all of a sudden they do tests now on fighters to see if they take a steroid, especially in the Olympics. Because
wasn't James Lights Out Tony?
Yes.
Didn't he get the busted taking? Did he test positive for
steroids? Mosley. So did Mosley.
How do fight James Tony?
Who? Mosley.
James Tony.
Tony got.
I'm talking to Harold about his era and all. We're not talking about the money,
because
I'm talking about Harold back in the day with him.
In the day, no, those guys didn't do those things. The only thing they took basically was really vitamin B12, and that shot, that was the best thing they did. You know, our thing was, like I said, 12, 15 rounds was very dangerous, okay? So any of those kind of things that would. When you get tired, you're tired. Steroids cannot help you when you're tired. And
correct.
And like Tony told you, you know, you just bulk. Steroids just to bulk you up to make you stronger. You don't want to be with your muscles all bulked out and tight and everything trying to go 15 rounds because you ain't going to make it. So basically, them guys didn't do it. Everything with them was natural strength and everything. That was the last thing they wanted to do was give you steroids because if your body is not loose, and relax, you cannot go 15 rounds at that time. So we know steroids was out the window. That's what come when you always saw a guy with a lot of big muscles and coming into the ring. We know we can beat him.
All you got to do is outlast him, right?
Right. That's all it was, and that was the whole key point of victory. So you know that big muscle stuff don't mean nothing to a boxer. So that was all. So steroids was definitely not the point.
Wow. Doc Stanley Sports Depth on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soda Channel Sports Depth of the show. Yeah, it's another monster here on a Sunday night. We're here also taking a moment or two to once again salute Black History Month. As you know, Black History Month is February, but the day before Black History Month starts is January 31st, the birthday of Jack Roosevelt Robinson, the first African-American to play in the major leagues and the first African-American to win the batting championship and an MVP award. 1949, Jackie hit his number 342, and he also led the league in stolen bases and became the first African-American to win the MVP award. Roy Campanella, 51, 53, 55, became the first African-American to win the MVP three times. 1955, Willie Mays became the youngest man in the history of baseball to lead the league and hit 50 home runs. In 1956, Don Newcombe became the first ever Cy Young Award winner in the history of baseball and the first African-American to win the Cy Young and the MVP in the same season, as did Jackie Robinson in 1947, became the first ever Rookie of the Year and, of course, the first African-American to ever garner the award. Will Chamberlain, the only man to ever, ever average 50 points a game, and that same year he pulled down 25 rebounds a game, played every minute of every game, and the only man ever to score 100 points in one game. Amazing night for Dipper that night. Not known to be a good free throw shooter that night, Will Chamberlain made 28 out of 32 free throws. Little Black History as we are in Black History Month. Back to the show. Doc Stanley, Sports Network on the Black Network, Rainbow Soda Channel, Sports Network of the show. Panel, have your way.
I was going to say too, Doc, and Will Chamberlain, don't forget, he was in that Bruce Lee movie.
I'm going to say something about, Jabbar.
Tell us how many assists Will Chamberlain had the night he scored 100.
hey, you know what? I'm going to have to look that up. But, you know, he said that if the Knicks defense hadn't played the way they were, he would have scored more. But, you know, people don't know that the reason why you shoot a free throw, that you can't go past the free throw line. That was because, huh?
That was because of Will Chamberlain.
Yeah. Why was that?
No, Wilt the Spill Chamberlain.
It was because Wilt Chamberlain.
Just take
it and
dunk
it. I told you. He used to dunk all his free throws. No. Wilt used to dunk all his free throws. You know, Wilt was so strong that I remember Walt Frazier told me that bouncing off Wilt's body was like hitting a concrete slab. Wilt Chamberlain Bill Russell, only two guys in the history of pro basketball to average 20 rebounds a game in a lifetime. And once again, Will Russell's birthday was the 12th of this month. John Patrick McEnroe was on the 17th, the 5th. I thought it was really ironic that Hank Aaron's birthday is on the 5th. Babe Ruth's birthday is on the 6th. At one time, they were 1-2 all-time home run champions. The 5th also, Roberto Alomar and McEnroe this month. And the 24th. The only switch hitter in history of baseball, over 500 doubles, 500 home runs, and 3,000 base hits, and number three on the Grand Slam list in baseball, Eddie Murray. Doc Stanley, Sports and Death on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soda Channel, Sports and Death for the show. We are in probably the last 10 minutes or so, but we've been talking everything. Once again, I told you here, you can't beat this panel, and it's the education that you learn. It's things that you thought you knew, that you didn't know, and now you know because we told you so. Gang, have your way.
Hey, I want to take a moment. Jackie Robinson's still up there as one of the all-time heroes, and I don't know if this panel knows much about it, but I was desperately awaiting Spike Lee was going to do a biography on Jackie Robinson, but I mean the real biography.
I heard about that.
Because if those of you know, if you watch the biography that Jackie Robinson starred in himself, It's probably the biggest disservice to himself as exists. They painted out that locker room to be, you know, nothing more than, oh, we don't want a black guy here. The things that were done to that man that he had to endure to pave the way for, you know, for black athletes everywhere is nothing short of astonishing. And I hope
– Tony, you come up with – I remember Larry Doby and Hal Jackson. The great Hal Jackson, who does the Sunday Morning Classic, who just turned 97 on November 3rd, my daughter and Larry Holmes' birthday. And there's two thoughts here, Tony, that you brought up. Larry Doby talked about, and Larry came up about 6-8 weeks later after Jackie, and he said, you know, when he was introduced to players, he would stick his hand out, and some would shake it, and some would not. And Hal Jackson, in his book, which is great reading, and also it should be must reading, because it's a great collaboration of both American entertainment and African-American history. And he said, you know, Jackie had called him and had talked seriously about giving up that whole thing. You know, Jackie, you know, I saw Mrs. Rachel Robinson earlier this week. And I hope I can run into anything like that. But, you know, Jackie seriously considered giving up. Now, Monty Irvin was the guy that they were originally looking at. And
I thought it was Roberto Clemente, Doc.
No, Roberto Clemente was back in 1950. Clemente came up in 1955, the year that the Dodgers.
Yeah, but wasn't Roberto Clemente supposed to be the first guy? And you know, because of his attitude and
Clemente was way too young. Clemente was way too young. The first guy considered was Monty Irvin, but Monty wound up going into the military, and he got sick, but. Harvey Farmer, who wrote the two great books, Fenway Park and Yankees.
Is he coming on the show, Doc, again? That guy, he's pretty good.
Yeah,
that
we'll
guy,
get him
Harvey,
back.
Yeah.
We'll get him back. And he's a close friend of Monty, and he said he talked to Monty, and Monty told him, Monty said, I couldn't have did it. He said, cause I would kill somebody. You know, I couldn't have done it. But Clemente was the Clemente was part of the Dodger organization, but you know, you always had the quota system, and he was in the Dodger organization. And the Dodgers tried to hide him. I mean, they would do crazy stuff. Clemente would be coming to the plate, and they'd pull him out the game. They wouldn't play him. You know what I mean? They would pull him out. And the Pirate organization told him, look, we know he's there, and we're going to take him. So, you know, might as well let him play. But he was originally in the Dodger organization. I have to take the first Latin player to play in the Major League Baseball he was from Venezuela. But no,
Virgil. Ozzie Virgil, Doc.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot. Ozzie Virgil Monty, though, also another story, you know, Bill Veeck was going to buy the Baltimore Orioles. And as the Orioles and the Cleveland Indians in 1944, the team was for sale. And his mind said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to straighten this thing. I'm going to integrate baseball. I'm going to buy this team, and I'm going to have Satchel and Josh and Willie Wells, and Charles J. Dent, and Max Manning, and Double Duty Rip. I'm going to have all the great players. And he sat down with the people on that Friday, and it was a done deal. All he had to do was come back on Monday to dot the I's and cross the T's. And somebody inadvertently got word to the commissioner, Keisha Mountain Landis, and when Vet came back that Monday, they said, oh, we already sold the team. Because he was going to get the, I know he was going to get the Baltimore Orioles, and had he bought the team, he was going to let Hal Jackson be the first ever African-American to do play-by-play. That was done, the first guy to do that was Bill White. The offer also was made to the late, great Arthur Russ George Jr., but Vec was going to integrate baseball before he went. And Vec had a lot of the mindset that Andrew Rube Foster had. You know, Vec, I think, kind of saw them accepting the whole team as opposed to one player. Rube Foster, when he brought about the Negro Leagues, his mindset was, you know what, they're not going to accept one player because they have to co-mingle with them. He said, but they'll take a team, therefore they can play against a team and not have to live with that team. And that's why he put the Negro Leagues
together. Wasn't there a woman back in the day that the black Yankees, the black baseball team, the black Yankees had made a formal challenge to the, you know, to the Major League New York Yankees
Every year, the Negro Leagues would play against the world champion of Major League Baseball. And every year, the Negro Leagues would win the series. So they said, okay, we got to do something. Okay, so what are we going to do? They got an all-star team. We're going to put our all-star team out there. So every year, the Negro Leagues would play the all-star team, okay? And they got the same results. They would always win. The Negro League would win the series, so Major League Baseball said, okay, we're going to solve this. We're just going to stop playing them.
Well,
so they stopped playing.
Yeah. And that was the other thing, too, Doc, but the real thing was dollars and cents. And the dollars and cents was the Negro League was drawing a lot of people to their games, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when they got Jackie Robinson, as I learned about it, is that Jackie came across because he had more – he was more stable, and he was more controlling than all the other players,
What Buck Lennon said about Jackie was that, and Jackie had to take that 2 years, he said the great Buck Lennon, called by some the black Lou Gehrig, or Lou Gehrig was the white Buck Lennon. He said Jackie wasn't the best player in the league, but he was the best suited because of his age. He was from California. He had some college education behind him. He had been in the military. So the mindset was Jackie was the guy that could adhere to the necessary traits to be the first. Now, Jackie, after the two-year ban was over, there was a manager in Philadelphia who was shouting some very negative traits, names at him. And Jackie walked across the infield and told him, look, for 2 years I had to take that bullshit. I don't have to take it anymore. You don't shut up.
Yeah.
I'm going to come over there and bust your ass. You know what I mean?
And Jackie was a really tough cookie. He really could have kicked Cardinals prison most of those guys' asses if it would have came down
once Jackie, the reins were off, you know, Jackie was the leader of the Dodgers, and Jackie was a fierce. Jackie has two great quotations. You know, one of them is, above all else, I hate to lose. When Bobby Thompson hit the home run to beat the Dodgers, Jackie Robinson watched Bobby Thompson touch every single base. You know, and then the great line that Jackie had, which I'll leave us with, was, a life is not important except the impact it has on another life. Doc Stanley Sports Def on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soda Channel Sports Def Show. We're in the closing minutes, and we want to thank the panel and our special guest, Tony. Tony, you and Danny Scott, gentlemen, we'll let you know we're on every week. We'd like to be part of the panel. We also, once again, send condolences out to the Houston family and the Carter family. Leave you with three thoughts. Live your life today and have to stand before God tomorrow. Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? Service to others is a space you pay for your room on earth. Dr. King, Muhammad Ali, and Dr. Stanley Assembly says, trust in God. Larry Hardy, say goodnight for us. Please, Larry.
This concludes another edition of Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley. We thank you for listening and encouraging you to tell a friend about Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley. You can hear that and many other great programs on the Blake Radio Network. Have a great day.
Lady A.
Yep.
You're still here. Tony's still with us? Okay. All right, gang.
Somebody hang.
Yeah. Okay, we're here. Well, okay, we're going to roll. Give me a call here at the house. Great show, gang, as always. Good to have Tony. Great insight. And, hey, we'll be back next week.
Hey, I want to ask you a question, Doc. What can I get
from no lights on, lights off today? Well,
no, I was going to ask Doc a question. When do I get Harold pictures? Because everything was about Harold today. I don't have any Harold pictures.
You mean with Harold pictures?
How come,
Listen. What you do, you go down and get yourself, a 8-foot by 10-foot Doc Stanley poster and put it in your room if you want to be in your show next week. But Anthony is an old fight guy, and he met Harold when Harold was matchmaker at the Garden. You know, he met Harold. You know, a lot of people don't understand just how good Harold Weston was. I mean,
Mel?
You know what I do?
I have an
autographed picture of Harold. I'll make copies for you. You know, to my man.
I don't want no copies. I want an original.
All you have to do is look
at the guys
that are
I want an original. Listen, Doc,
bought.
When are you going to get it in your head? Gangsters don't dance, they boogie. What are you talking about?
Hey, no, Rooney, she reminded me of that Coca-Cola commercial. The real thing.
Indeed.
I wish for my, did Mike throw me in the car,
All you have to do is look at Howell's record and the guys that he fought, man. Looks like a virtual who's who of Boxing Hall of Famers.
He fought Benitez. He fought Palomino. He fought Cuevas. You know, they fought the Cuevas fight thinking that his jaw was broken, and it wasn't. I mean, there's four guys, you know, my guys, my fighters. Okay, Ali, Duran, Harold, because of Harold.
I was waiting for it. I said wait for it.
Because of Harold.
It's coming. Duran, here we go.
Now, Hector Camacho. Now, you know, and I said this about Hector. Okay, Hector beat Ray and Duran when they passed their prime. Hector could beat both of them in their prime. If Hector Camacho would have stayed, but you understand, you know, it's amazing sometimes the little thing that sways you. And, you know, Camacho, you know, what had happened to Camacho, as Harold told me, Camacho got betrayed. And not somewhat betrayed. I mean, so it was a money thing. And Hector told him, hey, man, you know, you didn't have to do that. Didn't have to do that. Right, Harold?
Yeah, they robbed him.
Hey, Harold, let me ask you a question. How good was Edwin Rosario back in the day?
Oh, he was all right. Good puncher. You know what I'm saying? Game guy, you know. But he didn't have no, you know.
He wasn't a Camacho, though, right? He wasn't a Camacho,
well,
right?
That was supposed to be the big showdown, Harold, him and Chapo Rosario and Hector.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be the big showdown.
It was in the showdown. But, I mean, you know, he was a good puncher, you know, straight ahead. He didn't do nothing out of the ordinary. I mean, you know, Camacho would have took him apart and everything. But I liked him. I mean, you know, he's a game kid. You had to fight him. I mean,
he showed up. He showed up and gave it.
Oh, he showed up. No, you're going to get entertained. Don't worry about it. You're going to get entertained.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Harold, when they first announced that Mike Spence had signed to fight Mike Tyson, what were your initial thoughts? Did you think Spence had a shot?
No. I didn't think Mike had a shot at all. Mike didn't really want to fight. The money was so great. That was what it was all about. That was about the money. Mike didn't really want to fight heavyweight. No.
All right.
I mean, after he knocked out Jerry Cooney.
Cooney.
Mike. Yeah, I mean, you know, basically, Mike really didn't want to fight for, you know, they got lucky with the Larry Holmes, got that decision over Larry Holmes, and, you know, and went on from that. But Larry beat himself in that fight. But
who that?
Larry made that statement about, you know, he can't carry my jock strap. That was the end. I knew he was going to lose that fight right then and there. You just don't make statements about a guy, a heavyweight like Rocky Marciano.
And think
you're going to get a decision.
What about Ronaldo Snipes?
and him when he was fighting? How good was Ronaldo?
Harold, I said if Snipes had hit Larry in the middle of the ring, he might have knocked Larry out. But when he hit Larry, Larry fell against the ropes and didn't go down. What do you think, Harold?
He had good instinct. When he got dropped, you couldn't get hit no harder than when Ernie Shaver hit him.
It's funny you said it. After I told you that, I thought about this. I remember I did an interview with Larry down in Eastern PA. Later to me, I'll do the two-part special. And I said, Larry, I said, I heard that when Chavis hit you, a flashbulb went off, and you thought it was a bolt of lightning. And like you said, he said, you know what, you're right. You know what? Tremendous point, Harold. He got up from Chavis.
He got nailed with Shapers, bro. He got nailed. He was hurt big time with Shapers. And he got up and fought his butt off. So, you couldn't get hit no more harder than that. Shapers nailed him. Most beautiful right hand I've seen with Shapers, bro.
Let me ask you this, Harold. You got the inside scoop. How come Larry, I always thought the guy was really a good fighter. Harold, how come he never would fight Greg Page when Page was coming up? How come he wouldn't fight Gregory Page?
It was all based on, at the time, it was just based on, at that time, Butch Lewis had Greg Page. And then when Greg Page left,
Butch,
he went over to Don. Then Larry left Don, and Larry did his own little thing, And so it never came about for Greg Page and Larry to fight. And so that's what it was all about. It was just a lot of political situation. Everybody's trying to get much leverage as they can off the fighters.
You fought Benitez, Palomino. And Cuevas, right?
I never fought Palomino. I fought Pepino Cuevas.
Would you think about Palomino?
He wasn't nothing. He couldn't fight. He got lucky.
Now who did he beat for the title?
He beat Stracy. Stracy knocked out Jose Napoli. Napoli was finished when he fought. That was my fight, and that's why some people pissed off with Palomino. But that was my fight and everything, because Napoli was supposed to first Stracy wasn't going to fight nobody. He was number one contender. He wasn't going to fight, and I was going to fight Napoli, right? Then Stracy turned around and said, "No, I'll fight Napoli." He fight Napoli, and I knew Napoli was finished after Napoli fought Amano Muniz. I knew he was shot. Because he fought Manny Muniz twice. And, he barely made it through the second fight. And I said, okay, we got him. And so, I wanted to beat Napoli's anyway because he had beaten Griffin. And so, I wanted to fight Napoli's because he had beaten Griffin. And so I knew I could beat Napoli's. And so basically, and now don't get me wrong, Napoli could fight. Napoli was nobody's joke. Napoli was pound for pound. Don't let nobody fool you. He was pound for pound welterweight.
When you say pound for pound, what do you mean by that now?
He's a great welterweight. He wiped out the welterweight division. There was really nobody around for a while. Yeah, Napoli was a champion for a long time.
Did he beat Hedman?
He knocked out Hedman. Hedman beat him the first time. They gave it to Napoli by 1 point. They made a rematch, and he stopped. Yeah, and then he stopped Hedman the second time.
Hedman didn't come in with his head right for the second fight?
It was just one thing about Napoli. Napoli's from that old school. You fight him once, the second fight ain't going to be the same way, okay? He done figured you out, and if he figures you out, then you got a fight on your hand, and that's the way he was. They call him a smooth as butter. That was his nickname. Montekio. He was bad, man. He was
Harold saying that.
He was sweet.
How in those days they didn't have the videotapes and stuff though, did they?
You had the regular tapes, your old fashioned tapes.
Oh, fight film.
Going on. Fight film, You saw that and everything. But he was sweet. He had a way of throwing an uppercut that you would never see. And that was the amazing part about it. That's the reason I studied him very well, because he was very, very tricky. The thing about Napoli is that you got to keep a good jab on him and be in good condition, because he just slips punches and come back and counter you so beautifully and throw 3-4 punches at it one time that you don't even see it.
Was he as good defensively as Wilfredo?
Oh yeah. Oh
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty high praise, Harold.
Yeah. Oh, he was sweet, man. I mean, he was. If you see his film, you see what I'm talking about. Oh, he was beautiful, man. I mean, he would be right there, and you think you can hit him, you can't hit him. I mean, he just had that technique, and he had power too. He was sweet. He was smooth. He was real smooth.
Is he still alive, Al?
I don't know. I heard he was. I mean, last time I heard he was. I haven't read nothing in the paper that he passed away or anything like that.
Okay. He was Mexican?
Yeah. He was bad.
It took a long time
for him to get a title shot.
Really?
Yeah, he was a bad dude, man.
Who did he beat for the title?
Curtis Cokes.
Curtis Cokes?
Yep. He knocked Curtis Cokes out.
Curtis Cokes was a welterweight champion for a while, too, right?
Right. Curtis Cokes was a welterweight champion for a long time.
Really?
Yeah.
No, because I got Curtis
on my
side.
I had to follow
now,
those guys,
was,
man.
Huh?
I had to follow them. We followed each other, man. Everybody knew who was bad now.
Where's Curtis from?
Curtis came from Texas.
Uh-huh.
Let me tell you, we all studied each other so well. The baddest dudes in the country, in the weight class, whatever they were, everybody knew everybody from top to bottom because you knew eventually you was going to fight him. It ain't like today. We knew we couldn't duck each other. We knew the day was going to come. We were going to, so you just.
And not only that, Harold, but a lot of folks thought that 47 was the most talented division of boxing anyway.
It was. That's because you had to be on your P's and Q's and find out who was coming up and who was there. I mean, that was the way the things were. And everybody.
Could Ray Lynn have done anything with Curtis or Jose?
It would have been there, but he'd have got beat. You know, the only thing that Ray would have had in his favor, which he had, and I don't know if he had it, but he probably would have had it back then too. He'd have had the political people on his side. You know what
really?
I'm saying? Yeah, that was the only thing that'd been in Ray's favor. But Ray would have got a spanking. Ray would have got a little spanking. You gotta understand, Melvin, you guys. And you would understand. You gotta say, guys were good, man. They were dangerous. This wasn't no joke. Like you picking your own opponent and all. It wasn't no. These guys were good, man.
Okay,
that's cool, Doc. Anybody that was in the top 15 would have been a champion today. Top 15 would have been a champion.
So Harold, Cokes,
these guys were
Cokes,
scary. These guys, when the matches were made and you saw it on the billboard, you said, damn, that's going to be a hell of a fight. And you said, damn, they're going to kill each other. That's how kind of fights they were used to make.
I wish we had that in boxing.
You've
been on your glory, Lady A.
I know.
Rewinding
tapes of Harold.
Would Tommy have beat Jose and Cokes?
Oh, yeah. Tommy would fit in any era, okay? But the problem with Tommy is that we would have found out, which everybody would have found out later on, like I did, Tommy didn't have good stamina. Tommy couldn't maintain, he always get tired and he'd fall apart. So if you knew you got to get Tommy past that fifth and sixth round, you were fighting enough to do that. But so, like I tell you, the five and six rounds like hell. I mean, so that's the big problem with Tommy. If you can go through the hell for the five and six rounds, then you'd be all right. But if you can't take it, you're going to get knocked out.
Well, if you had been in this corner, Howard, how would you have told him to approach Hagler? Would you have said the bombs the way that he did and lost that, or would you have had him just use the jab and bide his time?
No, Tommy going to fight Tommy. That's Tommy's strategy. Tommy is there to knock you out in the first in five rounds. That's Tommy's strategy. I don't care who he fight. He can fight a heavyweight, whatever. He's going to try to knock you out, try to kill you in the first five rounds. You got to survive. You got to find a way to survive. That's the way Tommy is.
So, in other words, when Emmanuel went out there with Tommy, all he did was just wind him up and let him go.
just let him go. And that's what it was. And he just felt that nobody, not too many men can take the power. Because Tommy had power in both hands, right hand and left hand. And he had a good jab. I mean, Tommy had it. Tommy was a full, you know, he was the whole package, man.
I told Tommy, I said, Tommy, every fight you ever lost, the other guy didn't win, you lost. But now, how did Blade beat him? Blade had knocked him out and beat him by decision, Harold.
Well, Blade was with me, and I told Blade, I said,
okay,
the way you
okay.
got to deal with Tommy, you're going to get your butt beat for the first 5-6 rounds. If
he
you're
did
still
too.
Standing, then you'll knock him out or you'll beat him. I said, but you got to take. See, Blade was tough. Blade was just tough. And that was a good fight. And like I said, if you can get Tommy past those 5 or 6 rounds after you take that beating, if you still got something left, you be in the fight. But
no,
you got to
right.
get past them 5 or 6 rounds. That's the whole thing about Tommy.
Blade said when he knocked out Tommy said, hey, man, you hit the hit, man.
Don't let me tell you, Blade got hurt, bro. Blade took a beating, too, now. And he'll tell
oh, no,
you,
yeah.
he took a darn beating for the first 5-6 rounds. Mm-hmm. And that
was
the whole thing about
Tommy. You was in his corner, Hal, for that one?
No. That's when he had double cross. I ain't gonna get into that. But you know, he got lucky, man. You know, he's able to find. I gave him the blueprint. He did it. You gotta understand, Mel. What I did to Tommy just opened up the door to blueprint. Who with guys that made that made that opened the door for Ray. That opened the door for Hagler. And then
everybody.
They all would tell you if I'd have got knocked out, nobody would knew how to figure Tommy Hearns out.
Mm-hmm.
But
isn't that ironic?
Way I handled
isn't that
Tommy,
ironic, Doc? What
you know,
I was saying, isn't that ironic?
Because the way I handled Tommy, then everybody had a way.
Because everybody, cause I tell you that because, but how did Blade outbox him the second time though? One of the
like I said, he just warmed down. No, the second time he was able because Tommy got leery. Because when Tommy got knocked out by him the first time. Then Tommy got their respect for him. Now Tommy wanted to be more of a boxer and try to save his energy, and that's
okay.
not Tommy Hearns. And he lost the decision.
Sure did.
And that
sure
was the people, that was the downfall.
But they say Tommy was a hell of a Doc Stanley Sports Desk, mic on, lights off. The Harold Weston portion, Harold Weston special, the former MSG matchmaker, first African-American, only African matchmaker in the history of MSG, the only MSG welterweight world champion. Harold, now, you know, we had Tommy, okay, he you say Blade came back and won the decision. He beat him on the decision. But Blade was a pretty tough guy himself, wasn't he?
Yeah, Blade, as I said, Blade became a good fighter because I made the adjustment and told Bobby Miles he had to train Blade. Because if he didn't do that, I would not accept Blade to fight for Madison Square Garden. Blade was thrown away. Aram had gave Blade up. He would not renew his contract with Top Rank. And Top Rank said, we don't want you no more. You know, you ain't going to be nothing. You are nothing but a club fighter. They threw him out. I knew that Blade could fight from the day I saw him from the amateurs. I just knew that there need to be, you know, you have to just move him out and fix him, polish him up. And that's when I told, at the time he had one trainer, his first trainer was training, and he took him as far as he can. I said, no, now you need, I said, Bobby, and I talked to Bobby Miles. I said, Bobby, you got to train. I said, if you don't train him, then I ain't going to do nothing with him. So Bobby said, okay, I'll do it. So Bobby started training. We started talking about the adjustments, and that's what made the Blade. But Blade was just an ordinary fighter until he came to me at the Madison Square Garden. That was the main thing about it.
Speaking
of Tommy and Blade and company, a guy that had all the physical tools, 6'2", big puncher, blah, blah, blah. I haven't heard some people say he might have been the next Ray Robinson. I doubt that. But how did
yeah,
he
well,
ask you
made that would
statement.
Teddy Brennan said that.
Let me ask Harold this one, Doc.
Hold on. Hold up. Teddy Brennan said that about who, Harold?
About Tom Aaron. He said he was the next Ray Robinson.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
He said
before,
when he's getting ready to fight me, he said he's the next Ray Robinson. I said, that's bullshit.
No, Doc, I was just going to ask Harold. Hey, Harold, would you have done anything or made any kind of change in the style of Mark Breland? Because for all of his physical tools, 6'2", can punch, would you have, I thought maybe he should have been better, Doc. I mean, how was it? The chin? What was it?
I boxed Mark Breland a couple of times, and when he came to my gym just to box me and everything before he turned. When he was getting ready to turn pro, but he was going to Olympics and they needed boxing, so they brought him up to my gym and so I told Mark, you know, you gotta understand, you got guys that comes into the sport and they think they know everything, and then they take a brilliant prospect like Mark Breland and baby him and really don't make him the superstar that he should have been made.
Wow, Harold.
But the thing is that I was talking to Mark and I told him that he's all right, but he's not all that. And I said, you know, you need to adjust some things to make yourself a better fighter. Now, I told that to his people. I guess they got offended by it, but I didn't give a shit. My point, excuse my language, but the fact is that they ruined a fighter that could have been a great fighter. And,
you know what, Harold, you're saying Emmanuel Stewart is saying what you said, you know, and not that Emmanuel
Damn
was
sure
saying that Shelly Finkel and them messed up Mark Breland.
Yep,
he messed up, he said, you know, and then Mark, dovetailing on that, got so upset with all the politics. He told me, you know, he didn't like the politics of boxing. You know, I mean, I can't hang out with Harold because I'm with Main Event and Harold with King. I can't talk to Doc because he's with Top Rank and Rooney is with the Duke. And he said, you know, he soured on the, he loved the amateurs, he soured on the pro. And Shelly Finkel undermined. Emmanuel Stewart, because Emmanuel said that what you're saying, how he said Mark Breland ran the crowd. He said Mark was the man. He said Mark was manhandling Tommy. He was manhandling Hill McKenty. He ran the Kronk gym, and you're right, as you always are, 99%, that the undermined and the wrong philosophy turned the guy who they were saying the same thing. Michael Kitts was calling him the next Ray Robinson too, Harold.
Yeah, because when I boxed Mark, and I told Mark, I said, you know, you're all right, but you're not great, okay? You're not as great as they tell you that you are. I said there's some things need to be worked on, and he said, Harold, that's the reason why I'm here is boxing you, you know. And he said, I'm trying to learn. I said, well, and then the other thing, you need a new trainer. I just told him, I said, you need a new trainer. I said, you know, you need somebody to really show you the technique of this whole thing. I said, you got all the tools in the world, but you just got the wrong people with you. And he, you know, he shook his head and blah, blah. But they had already gave him $1 million. So, you know, he had to go with the people
that
gave him.
Harold, that's exactly what Emmanuel said, that he came to him and Finkel had offered $1 million. And Emmanuel said, you know, you better go ahead and snatch it. You know what I mean? Because Mark came to him.
Right.
Mark came.
And not only that, Doc, but if you remember, George Washington was the guy who had guided him to all of those Golden Glove titles and what have you. And when he got to the pros, they switched him, and then it made George like a third or fourth second and replaced him with some
what Harold was saying, though, even at that point, it had come to the point that George would have been able to take him no further. Am I right, Harold?
Yeah, right. George was at his limit, too. But I thought that, the change should have been with a much knowledgeable trainer than what they brought to the table. But that was the Shelly Finkel and Duva's whole little thing that they had. And I just told them that, you know, they had some good – you know what's so bad about that whole group is that they had some good, good fighters. I mean,
they had Mark, Meldrick,
and they
Purnell.
Ruined all of those kids, all of them.
They ruined them all, Hal?
Which one is a superstar?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they did it the same way. Systematically, they did the same thing with them that they did. But what about Georgie Benton? George wasn't the head trainer. Duva was the head trainer, right?
Let me just say this: they made a fight and they hated me. Okay, they come to me and they want to make a fight with Juan Laporte and Lockridge. Okay,
Rocky Lockridge.
Rocky Lockridge. So these fools thought that they had me going. Right, I make the fight. We fighting on CBS. We make the fight. We are 5-1 underdog. Okay, I said, who is making these odds? Juan Laporte is 5-1 underdog. Okay, I said, I come to the fight because I had a fight before. I flew in that day, you know, the fight, and Juan had weighed in everything. I said, everything cool. I said, yeah, boom, boom. I said, all right. I said, I heard this at 5-1. I said, oh, man, let me go get it. I got me about 2,000 to put it on Juan, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I told everybody, somebody asked me a question, said, who was going? I said, we're going to knock this little punk out. And so everybody looked at me, and they said, Hal Weston said that they're going to knock him out. Then Shelly said, oh, Weston don't know what he's talking about. I said, we're going to knock him out cold, if I'm not mistaken, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, it's going to be within 3 rounds. I said, and they said, well, how? I said, first, the stupid fool ain't never got hit before because you already put him with bums. I said, the second situation is that he comes right to you, and he always dropped that left hand when he tried to get ready to throw that left hook.
I said,
the other thing, Juan can punch with the right hand. And the second thing, Juan can take a punch. So if I'm adding this thing right, we going to knock his ass out.
He diagnosed it perfect.
And I said, by the way, I'm going to sit at ringside with a bottle of champagne and watch it. Boy, when Juan hit, Rocky Lockridge came out and hit Juan with an overhand right. Whang! Okay? Juan took the shot real good. So, you know, covered up, boom, boom, boom. Man, in that second round, when Juan said, oh, what? It was all over.
Sure.
And I just sat there with my legs crossed and just say, oh, Mr. Knowledgeable Boxing Man, Shelly Finkel, what do you say now?
And he did it, Harold, and Juan did that, Harold, just as you said, with Rocky on the attack, with his back to the ropes, hit him with some shots, couple of uppercuts, and it was boom, boom, game over.
Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am.
That's right. And they were pissed off with me from then on. And then they come with another fool that they were going to knock me out again when we fought a guy named Earl Hargrove.
You talking about for the Mark Medell fight in AC?
Mark Medell fight. Kid was 29-0 with 28 knockouts. And so, you know, the smartest person out of all of them was Russell Peltz. Russell Peltz. Like I said, had another show the night before. I go down to Atlantic City. I'm there. Russell's waiting for me. He said, man, where you been? I said, man, I had a show. I'm just getting here. I said, everything all right? He said, yeah, everything. He said, I'm just coming in to ask you a question. I said, what? I said, well, let me put my stuff upstairs. We go to dinner. Let me go have some food, then we can talk. He said, okay. He said, I'll meet you in a restaurant. So I go down. I said, what's the problem? He said, there ain't no problem. I just got to ask you one question. I said, what? He said, the contract's signed. We know what's up. All right. I take your word. He said, forget about all those stupid fools out there. You the one I want to ask. What's going to happen tomorrow? He said, we're going to knock you out. He said, what you mean? I said, Russell, your guy been knocking people out in 1 and 2 rounds for the last 3 years. Okay? You've been fighting bums. My kid's been going 10. Them been, you know, no how been taking a few fights, been knocked down. And we're going to knock you out. We're going to wear your little butt out. If you throw them bombs about the 6th or 7th round, we're going to knock you out. Russell said, oh, my God, I don't even have a contract with you if you win. I said, Russell, don't worry about it. Sure enough, then the manager comes, Earl Hargrove manager comes in and said, yeah, I heard you talking about you're going to knock us out. How much money you want to bet? How much money? I said, bet $1,000. A little gentleman bet. He said, all right, $1,000. I said, but you know, you guys are, you know, favored by 4-1. He said, I'll give you 2-1 favor. I said, all right, give me 2,000 to 1,000. Okay. So, all right. So I'm sitting there and I'm just looking at the fight. Fight going just like I planned. Take the shot, take the 3 rounds, keep digging. Let the 3rd round come, keep digging. 4th round, time to take him out. 5th round, bang, gone. We're champions. That was the end of that situation.
Hey, but how? Wasn't Tommy a good boxer in the amateurs?
Tommy didn't have no knockouts in the amateurs. That was the amazing part about Tommy.
He was never known
to be a puncher. Yeah, he was never known as a puncher. He was known as a boxer.
Wow.
He had no knockouts in the amateurs?
No, he had no knockouts in the
amateurs. That is shocking. Isn't it, Doc? That's shocking.
Yeah.
They'll tell you that. Tommy was not known for a KO puncher in the amateurs.
What happened, Harold? What brought the change about?
I mean, the
amateurs, the gloves or something? What was it, Harold?
No, it was just that they just changed the style. I guess they brought a new guy into the gym and showed Tommy how to get more leverage on the puncher, and he just started being a puncher when he turned pro.
Oh, so Emmanuel
was
didn't
never
have an amateur.
An amateur. No, he was not a KO. He lost the decision to Aaron Pryor two times in Olympic trials.
Twice?
Yeah.
No, so he didn't have Emmanuel as a trainer, as an amateur.
Yeah, he did. But the fact is, he was a boxer. Like I'm saying, he was a boxer. He was not a big puncher.
Okay.
He was a big. He was a real boxer. He was a boxer, you know. And that's what Tommy. Yeah, Tommy always had fast hands, but he was just a boxer. There was never that punching situation. It just happened that he just started, bang. You know, people started getting knocked out. And they started working on it, and Tommy became a great puncher.
Hey, Harold, a guy that won a couple of titles that no one ever mentions. I don't even know if folks even remember that he existed. But, Harold, how good was Mike McCallum?
Mike McCallum was smooth, real smooth. He was very good. Mike just didn't believe in himself a lot, but Mike was real smooth. Mike was one of those, Mike was one of those guys, he liked boxing, but he really didn't like boxing. You know what I'm saying? He just wanted to do it because he was pretty good at it, but he really, really, like, didn't have that real desire for it, like, you know, like myself. But he knew he was good at what he was doing. And I guess, you know, where he came from, you know, he was on the Olympic team from his country and all that. And that was the whole thing with Mike. But Mike,
how good was Colonel Whitaker? Was he overrated?
Colonel Whitaker? No,
yeah.
Colonel, he was fair. I mean, he was good. I ain't going to take nothing from Colonel. He was a real good little crafty little boxer and everything. I mean, you fight him, you're going to have a fight on your hand. And one thing about him that I liked about Colonel, he loved to fight. I mean, you know, he fight. I mean, my thing is that he was just one stationary type of fighter. There was nothing slick about him. You know, after you knew the basics that he was going to do, the three couple of moves that he did, that's all he's going to do all night long. And that was his downfall. That's what I saw in a lot of, you know, all these fighters out there today.
But
they get a one-track mind, and that's what they stay with.
Wasn't George Benton a good trainer, though?
Yeah, George was a good trainer, but I'm saying everybody gets the one-track mind. And even with Georgie, when Georgie fought as a fighter, he only had a one-track mind. His whole thing was pop, 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 left hook, maybe hook off the jab, pop, pop, throw a left hook to the body. It was just a basic standard. It never changed it up. And that's when he fought Reuben Hurricane Carter beat him because Carter kept the pressure on him and everything. And he knew he'd just get his hand off. Yeah, you just got to know that everybody's not control, you know, everybody's got one station mind, like I said, and they learn certain basics of things and they stay with those same basics.
How good was Hurricane?
Hurricane was tough. I mean, he wasn't no great fighter, he was tough. That's all it was. He was just tough. They when Griffin fought Hurricane, he was supposed to be in a tune up fight.
Wow.
He was a tune-up fight, yeah.
Because Griffin fought Hurricane?
Griffin was welterweight champ of the world. And he needed to do so. Griffin is going to fight Carter over the weight for a tune-up fight, because then Griffin's going to defend his title with, I forgot who he was getting ready to fight it. He was going to defend his title with, I forgot who the hell he was fighting for. Manny Gonzalez. I forget who it was, but he was getting ready to fight somebody else after. But Griffin, he was a tune-up fight, and Griffin won Fighter of the Year. That's how strong it was. He was a tune-up fight. Griffin had won Fighter of the Year already, and Carter knocked Griffin out one round.
Really?
Yeah.
He knocked Emo out?
Yeah, in one round. So they fought over the weight. Carter was a middleweight. Griffin was a welterweight. There wasn't no in-between weights like these fools fight before.
Are you serious?
You're a middleweight. Oh, yeah. Middleweight.
So when Ray Robinson fought LaMotta, he was a welterweight fighting the middleweight.
Right. When Ray Robinson fought for the light heavyweight title, that was a light heavyweight champion. It wasn't no Don, you know, come in at 167. No, bro. He was 175.
So you said Ray Robinson came in at a full 75.
Yeah, 175, right.
And Ray came in as a middleweight.
Yeah, Ray came in like 164, 160, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. And Ray was Ray
that
thing,
fight, but
Ray,
for the
Ray,
heat,
Ray,
from what I hear.
Yeah, that's the only thing that beat Ray was the heat. But Ray knew that when he was fast and throw more punches. And Ray was beating the dog out of Max. That wasn't even no contest, really. Ray just got tired. It was just the heat. Nobody was going to get that hot.
Art Russ said, I never heard what Art told me. Art Russ said, Doc, it was so hot that the pennants looked like washcloths, and his wife, Edna. Edna had a white dress on. He said the red belt faded into the dress.
No. Think about this, Doc. It was so hot, they had to get another replacement of a referee to come in and referee the fight.
Yeah, really don't
want
to drop, yeah.
See, Ray said what he was pissed about is that when they took the referee out, they should let the fighters sit down in between the rounds instead of just letting the fighters continue to fight. He said that.
No, but the referee had came in between the rounds. They had to bring another referee in because the other one fell out. The first one fell out.
Yeah, but when he fell out, I thought the fighters were still fighting while he fell out. I thought they just dragged him out the ring.
No. Okay. The round was over, and he said, "Man, I can't go." And they put in another referee came in, and he refereed the rest of the fight.
Wow.
You know, something like it's funny because Angelo Dundee had said that in the Thriller in Manila, he had no idea how they made it, that just going up and down the ring steps that he almost did make it. So he said, I have no idea how those guys would war like that in that heat with that humidity.
And I can imagine when I fought Benitez in Puerto Rico and how hot it was down there that time, of course. I can imagine with those guys were fighting more heat. Mine was like 125. About 125 degrees. I wonder, was it 110, 115 in Puerto Rico? And then you got the lights in too,
the TV lights too, right?
Yeah, right. And they fought outside and they had TV lights and everything. And we had TV lights too. But my point is that heat is something else. I mean, a doctor came to me after the fight with Benitez, and he looked at me. He told me if I get the hell away from me, because he needed the air to start breathing in my pores. And so, you know, he told the guys, he said, put some ice on him. I mean, he said, you guys could have died out there.
That's you and Benitez?
Yeah, it's Benitez. Like, he said, you guys could have died out there. He said, the pace that you guys fought and the way y'all fought, he said, it's amazing. You guys could have died out there under that heat that we was fighting under.
Well, Dev Howard, you weren't just fighting Benitez. You were fighting the elements.
Yeah, I was fighting everything. Yeah, it was, but you don't
know.
Now,
Benitez, was his corner in the shade?
Yeah, he was in the shade, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they had you in the dark and the sun. Man,
it would have made no difference if they put me in the jungle, boy. If the fight going to be made, just go, let's do it and let's see what the hell happens.
I hear.
Hey, now that's what you're talking about, fighting from the old school, Doc. That's the way
Yeah. Who's
you can't
your
get along, so we're gonna get it on.
Yeah, who's your top three guys, Harold?
What you mean?
Fighters. If your favorite three.
Oh, I mean it would be Sugar Ray Robinson, Emil Griffin, or Muhammad Ali.
So Sugar Ray, even though you say he duck guy, he's still number one.
Oh yeah, I just love Sugar because of the style he had, man. He was just so smooth, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean he had this element. I mean, this charisma that he had was so smooth, and that's what I liked about Ray. You know, I just liked that about him, and that was just, you know, that was amazing. And then, you know, he could fight too. But I mean, the point is that he was real cool. He was real cool.
And what was it about Emil that you liked so much?
Emil was somebody that nobody really even thought that was going to be champion of the world. But besides just being champion, he was a great champion. And that was the amazing part about Emil. Because when Ray Robinson quit, Ray and then Emil just took the throne from there, man. And he did it in Ray's honor to be just like Ray Robinson, winning as many titles as he won. And fighting everybody and beating everybody. Griffin was a great welterweight. He was a great welterweight champion. He was a great champion all the way around.
Yeah,
he said nobody.
You said you felt that as a welterweight he could have beaten Ray.
It's been a hell of a fight.
Okay.
I told you. Right. I just thought that reason why I think he'd beat Ray because Griffin was a good 15-round fighter. Ray started fading going into the 15th round. And, you know, after that 10th. Yeah, he started. If you look at Ray Robinson fight, if going 15, you can see he starts fading a little bit in those fights. He don't throw as many punches in those last several rounds. You know, he does a little flurry and that's it. Griffin stays busy. And Griffin goes strong after the 10th round. And that was the great part about Griffin. But when Griffin fought Joey Archer, Griffin was getting the dog beat out of him for the first 10. But he came back in them last five and just beat Joey Archer.
And what is it about Ali that you liked?
Everything. You know, Ali let me understand what it is to have the strength of just standing up for what you believe in, and don't let nobody take that away from you, and believe in the fact that, hey, you know, if this is what you're going to do, just stand up and do it. Under all the things that he went through and still came out on top, you had to praise that man of his of the gallantry that he was as a fighter and as a man.
I think about that when he beat the when he fought Lister the second time and said, "Hey, my name ain't Cass anymore. My name is
right.
Muhammad Ali."
Yeah.
And remember he said,
you know.
And remember he told him too, he said, "Whatever the consequences is for standing for my faith and religion of Islam, Muhammad, I'm willing to suffer. Go through machine gun fire, man."
Yeah, because, you know, before that, but when Malcolm X was underneath his, when he was underneath Malcolm X, and Malcolm X said one thing that always stays with me. Malcolm X said, "If you don't believe in what you're doing, if you're not willing to die for it, then don't do it at all."
Dr. King said, "If a man hasn't found something to die for, then life isn't worth living."
Yeah, and that's the truth. Mm. And that's the truth. And so it goes deep. And, you know, we know a lot of men ain't going to put themselves on that kind of scale, but when you got men that's willing to do that and really believe in what they're doing, you got to believe. And that's what made Ali to me, because when he started talking, he started doing, and he stood up, and no matter how it went, and when he told the government, he said, "Boy, y'all can put me against the wall and kill me right now." He said, "But I'm not going to never give up my faith." That was strong back in them days, boy.
Hey, listen, Jim Brown said, and Rooney, I've told this story, Jim Brown, Lew Alcindor, he wasn't a Jabbar, then Bobby Mitchell, Bill Russell brought Ali in, trying to say, "Hey, bro, you know what I mean, man, you know, go ahead on in, ain't nothing happen." Jim Brown said, after talking with Ali for a little while, they said, "Hey, man, we had to stop because his conviction was so deep." He said, he would have converted us. He said his conviction was so deep, man, that if we had to stop, he said, because he would have converted us.
Yeah, I mean, shit, almost made me be a Muslim. I was getting ready to go down there and join.
Yeah, you know what? A lot of people did because of him. You know,
he
brought a recognition, attention, and class to that religion worldwide that it never had. I mean, a lot of people, you know, side on because you're Muslim, but at the same time, you know, he took that religion to heights unparalleled.
Oh yeah, I mean, him and Malcolm X, they took it to a level that they never thought they were gonna go, and that was the key point there. Malcolm.
Hey, let me ask you something, Harold. Did you ever have any trouble, Harold, making 47? And ever have? I mean, the guys today always seem like they have weight problems, Harold. Any problems
Rooney,
with you at all?
Rooney, hang on a second. Hang on a second, gang, since we're doing this. Let's kick it.
All day, all night, all the time. BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Dude, Rooney.
Yeah, again?
No, Rooney.
You know what I'm saying? How these days, all the guys except the heavyweights seem like they have all kinds of trouble making their contracted weights. Did you ever have any trouble, you know, making the weight, Harold? Have trouble, you know, 4 or 5 pounds over, have any trouble getting it off, anything like that?
No, when I turned pro, I was 47. I won the 47-pound championship in a Golden Glove, and I stayed 47 until I retired.
Really?
Wow, that's
yeah.
Don't you think that's kind of random?
Could you
maintain that?
Could you have fought middleweight,
Harold? I could have. No, not really. I wasn't that big, Doc. I was a real I was a small guy.
Okay,
I'm only 5'8". I mean, I could afford it, but all the guys I boxed in the gym was middleweights and stuff like that. When I fought Vito at 154.
Okay.
I thought he'd be 154. And I wasn't even 154. I could have been like, I had breakfast and stuff that morning. I never had breakfast for a weigh-in. And I had breakfast, and I came in like 151 or something like that.
Really?
Yeah. So when I fought Vito,
would you consider your style more of a boxer puncher? Because I was looking at your Tommy fight. I'm sorry, I was looking at your Tommy fight again about a week ago. And what I liked about you, Howard, was not only that could you punch, but you were smooth, real slick.
Howard, my man, baby.
It was all about me being just smart and being an all-around fighter, and that's all I wanted my father to teach me, which he did. And that was the greatness because there was always something I could learn more into the sport. So I was more just whatever it takes to win the fight, it was the key point. So I had to box, I could box. If I had to slug, I could slug. So I just learned all the avenues that I wanted in the boxing world. I wanted to be the best. And my father made me the best, and that was the key point.
You know what's funny to me, Harold and Doc? I would have been under the impression that somebody on a championship level like Harold would have said, well, wow. I mean, obviously this was too late for him, but they were all 15-round title fights. But I'm thinking that champions like Harold would have said, wow, are you kidding? 15 to 12 on my day, I'd have jumped at that. But actually, Harold, it seems like you're disappointed that you champions would prefer to go to championship limit or at least contracted to go 15 rather than 12.
Yeah, because you got to understand that, you know, a lot of guys you're going to fight be faster than you, and you can't catch up with them until, like, about the eighth round or ninth round. And that was a key point of you winning the fight. I mean, these are strategies that you go through and ideas you go through when you're taking a fight. You know, he's faster than me. I know it's going to take time. I'm going to be losing a fight, but I know I can catch him in the later round. And that's the whole thing about the boxing, because fatigue is going to fall in. I don't care what you do. Fatigue is going to fall in. How you handle fatigue is the key point. And everybody
he's coming with a fastball. I know he's coming with a fastball.
That's awesome stuff, Doc, and I consider myself a big fight fan and fight guy, but even I never thought of it like that. Good job, Harold. Awesome information.
Yeah. I don't care how it looks, and that's what was my victory, because I knew everybody gets tired, and how they got tired, how they handled it.
Hey, how you doing, everybody?
I knew that a lot of fighters couldn't handle fatigue, and that's because my whole strategy when I fought, it started from round one. We're going to start a fast pace from round one, and I'm going to get stronger as the fight goes on. So that's what scares all the fighters when they fight me, because I'm going to get you tired. You're going to get tired. And we starting that. We going full blast from the first round on. You know, everybody wants to feel each other out. No, there ain't no feeling out with me. We fighting from the round one. And if you can take the team,
hey,
we go
it,
down
Doc,
there,
I got
and you gonna be all right.
Doc Stanley, Sports
Doc.
Step on the Blake Radio Network. It is Mike on Lights Off in Education with one of the best.
It really is,
Howard.
All kinds of education.
And, you know, we just started sitting here. We really weren't looking to do Mike Lights off mic on, but Harold just started some interesting thing. The knockout, Tommy Hearns with no knockouts at all as an amateur. I tell you what, and what about it is too is that I remember seeing Harold in that fight in Puerto Rico because we thought Harold wanted to fight the guard, and for you to tell me that the doctor told you, man, that you guys should have died out there, and you have said so many times on this show, man. You have said, you know, guys in my era and me, willing to die. You know, and you talked about too, and you know, it's something that, and let you guys go in a few minutes, man. They don't say the day that they said in your day how you guys had your hands licensed because you guys hands were weapons, and today it's not the same, Al.
No, it's not the same. I mean, you know, these guys is brought up more of on a soft edge. We had to be brought up rough. I mean, we had to know how to be rough because life was rough for us, and we all understood that. But the fact is that, you know, the time has changed, and you know everything has changed the way where you know you're more protected by a few things, and that's the way it is. But we had to know how to fight with our hands if you can fight. But you couldn't, you know, I remember when I was growing up, I mean, if you got beat up outside and running home and cry, they'll send your ass back out and say, go out there and fight that boy again. I mean, that was the way it is. Don't come back here and cry.
I know you let that boy hit you.
Right. So, you know, one thing about that bully stuff, you know, ain't no such a bully, boy. You have to fight. They'll take, and you come back, check down ground, they come back with, they say, come out here, boy, you're going to beat this boy's ass now. You will come on with me, because you're going to beat this boy's ass. And your family, your mom,
Harold,
and your dad going to come with
you. And you know the funny thing about what you do, Harold? Folks have really no, they think they know, but they really have no idea how much hard it takes to do for a living, Harold. I remember talking to Mike Tyson once, having a private chat. Laughing at him. I said, you know something, Mike? You knock guys out so fast that folks think what you do is easy, man. We laugh.
But you know what? That's the easy part. See, what Mike didn't understand, this is where Mike lost, you know, this is where my downfall was. Mike wasn't used to fatigue, like we just talked about earlier, right?
Mm-hmm,
when Mike got
right.
tired, Mike fell apart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anybody can sucker punch you. Anybody can hit you with a shot and knock you out. But what happens when you not hit that man and you don't knock him out? Now where do we go from here?
So Harold, you're basically saying that it's not the greatest thing in the world. You're basically saying out that it's not the greatest thing in the world.
No,
if a guy has, say, I don't know, 10 knockouts in the first two rounds and he's had 12 fights. You want your guy to get some work in so he knows what it's like to experience fatigue and work.
I want him to experience the pain of getting hit, getting knocked down, getting back up, show me what you got. I want him to get tired. He's got to pull it out in the last two or three rounds. That's what
Marion
I want
Boykin, to Marion Boykin says, it's not till the guy hits the canvas, till the guy loses, that you find out what he's about.
What you got made of. I mean, I can give you 100 wins, but they don't show me what you made of.
We was out and I was working with Don King. And, went horseback riding with these guys, man. And my stirrup got caught. And fell off the saddle. So the saddle fell off the horse. And I got back up and then set up. And the guy said, hey, you take another horse. I said, no, man. I got the same horse, man. And the cat looked at me and said, hey, man, we like that, baby. He said, you're a cowboy. The cat said, man, you know, he said, hey, man, you know, we keep you out here, man. We make you some kind of cowboy, man. But that's it, man. That's it. Another horse, still horse. Shit, what the horse? I said, what's got for? Hey, this is my horse. You ain't getting on my horse. Kiss my. And you're right, Hal, man. It's the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in times of convenience and comfort. It's where he stands in times of trial and controversy.
Right.
And Tony talked tonight, man. Nobody had no idea what Jackie was going through. And you talk so much while Ali is so much in your eyesight, is not only just a champion inside the squared circle, the sweet, you know, science, but outside the ring, man. Jackie Robinson, a life is not important. It's the impact it has on another life. No. Clemente said, you know, if you're on earth and you got a chance to help somebody and you ain't doing it, you know, you're wasting your time. And you know, you're right. You know, I mean, you know. Anybody likes it when you're winning, but you know, how do you act when you lose? Guy, you say, hey man, I ain't gonna play no more. Like, hey man, I can't. I know there's a guy in that block, man. The guy says, man, the worst thing you can do is beat this mother's up. He said, coach, now you got, if you had a hard time beating him, then forget about it. You ain't gonna be there. His fortitude is, hey, he coming back to get you. And I think they always said that about you, how people always knew whether you had a championship belt or not. You was a champion.
Well, you know, Doc, I always say this in life, is that the people make you who you are. You know what I mean? No, those few men that are supposed to have the title of president or vice president of anything, but who really makes the situation is the people. When the people respect you and the people love you, that's the most important thing to me. They're the ones that really makes who Harold Weston's going to be, who Muhammad Ali's going to be, you know.
The people
champion.
You got the people champion.
That's what it's all about.
Them classic fights, man, at the Garden, man. And you know, you said it. It's like this.
I don't care if they don't recognize me or speak about me or being the first African-American matchmaker and master square, all being part of that that whole group of 100 years, and there's only been a few matchmakers, Master Greg Garden. They never mentioned me. I don't care. But you know what I know? I know the people that knew me about there back in the day, they know I was, and that's all that counts. As long as the people
and
know
the people who saw your work, Kyle, because the guy that Doc had on earlier from the Navy, I believe it was.
Yeah,
hey, man, he just couldn't believe that he had Harold Weston Jr. on the same
line. Hey, Harold, like I don't know nobody.
Right.
You know, I said, listen, can't nobody top this crew and panel and what you call Danny Skiles called me, man. He said, hey, Doc, man, thanks for having the guy in the show. He said, man, the guy turned out not as bad as we thought. You know what I mean? We wanted to convert that guy Tony tonight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know?
You know what, Doc, and you guys can understand it. You know, when you've been on the front line, like I have been from the day I was born, mm-hmm. and been through the things that I have been through on the front line, not mm-hmm. giving none, had to work hard for everything I got, and I'm standing here today, all right, getting ready to hit that 6-0, and able to talk and speak and really display things to you and give young men advice and everything. I have nothing more to say. My accomplishment is really has been there, and that's all that counts. And
you know, nobody gave
you
nothing. And I remember Tiger Woods' mother saying one time, she said, you know, ain't nobody gave Tiger nothing.
No.
You know? No. Ain't Tiger nothing. Gentlemen, we're going to about close it out here. Doc Stanley Sports Up on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soda Channel. Sports Up for the show. It's been mic on, lights off, but it's been like our part two. You know, we've done Harold as one of our documentaries before. And Black History Month, you got a chance to talk to, he says, if they don't recognize, we recognize the first ever African-American matchmaker in the history of Madison Square Garden, the one and only MSG Welterweight Champion. And we recognize Harold because he's a part of Black History Month, not because he's my dearly beloved friend, not because he's a part of our panel, not because he is the only African-American matchmaker, but because he's a part of African-American history as well as part of this panel. He's a person who's made a difference, a person that validates what Jackie Robinson said, a life is not important except for the impact it has on another life. Iran the Blade Barkley, Hector Camacho, Mark Madow, Juan Laporte. You're right. World champions. Because Howard Weston...
Bernard Hopkins.
That's right. You know what? People forget. The oldest champion used to... That's right. Bernard Hopkins. And I remember forever... I remember when I walked in one day, my daughter, you handed me 20, give my girl some shoes. And I walked in on another day, and Harold Weston was on the phone. And Harold Weston simply said, I don't care if he's green, white, blue, or yellow. Can he fight? And the rest, they say, is history. I mean, you didn't have to say, can he fight like me, because they couldn't. But it's been a pleasure. This time sitting there, Lady A, she must, I don't know how she cocked out, but Harold, you're an important part of this panel, and tonight, you know, the history that you always bring, the answers that you bring, and you know, they talked about Ray tonight. You say, hey, Doc, Ray Leonard is a liar. Harold said, hey, Ray Leonard, you know, and but on a scale of 1 to 10, what kind of rating would you give Ray Leonard?
I give him a high rating, Doc. I said the things I said about Ray, but Ray was a darn good fighter, man. You know, he gave you his all. He had a lot of heart. And, you know, you don't become champions like he did. I mean, he beat Marvin Hagler. I mean, you know what I'm saying? He beat Marvin Hagler, and he fought Tommy Hearns. And, I mean, he fought everybody that was out there. And Ray got, I mean... You gotta give him his, you know, you gotta give him his just due. I mean, but you know, I'm always gonna give him a hard time because he ducked me, didn't want to fight me. But I don't blame him because I was gonna spank him. I was gonna really spank him.
Hey Doc, I know we're closing, but I just have to ask Harold quickly. Hey Harold, you fought all the greats, all the Hall of Famers, people on your level as a fighter. Did the hype that honey, the Tommy Hearns, like a Hearns Leonard fight or anything, or you and Hearns or you and Gravis? Hey Harold, did the hype ever affect you at all? You know, a huge fight, everybody's gonna be talking about it, family, friends. Did the hype ever affect you at all, Harold?
No, you gotta understand, man, is that when you boxing guys like Emil Griffin, Ismael Laguna, Dick Tiger, Carlos Ortiz, and you boxing all these great fighters.
Edmund Lewis.
Yo, fighting Hedgman. When you box those guys in the gym, you already at a status where those other guys don't mean nothing to you. Because these guys are already greatness I'm dealing with. And this is in the gym. But I'm around them. And I'm able to have that kind of experience to be in there with them. That's enough for me. So what do I care about a Tommy Hearns? What do I care about a Fred? It didn't mean nothing to me. I'm there with greatness already.
Rooney, I'm going to say this to you. They did a story on Harold Weston, not in the New York Post, not in the Daily News, not in El Diario. It was the New York Times.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.